Development Budget Division will now be in order. Is the tape on? Okay, good. Today's date is Tuesday, April 14th. And so the room is filled with people who I know are waiting to hear the Senate Higher Ed Omnibus Bill. And in a very short time, you will do that. But before we do that, you are all in for a treat because we are going to take some of our time to hear from some of the University of Minnesota Medical School's greatest international research leaders. And I just want committee members and those who are following the committee to understand the reason we are doing this is because you will see within the framework of the omnibus bill a significant investment being proposed to the UMN Medical School. And we want people to understand that in the context of what that investment provides. What do we get for those dollars, and why would we take that percent of our total budget and direct it in that way? And so we think because of that, and because we have not had a hearing on this specific initiative, that we accepted Senator Cohen's suggestion and request to actually put a spotlight on this part of the bill. So we're going to begin with that presentation, and then it will be followed directly by a review of the omnibus bill proposal. We'll take amendments, and if we're ready, we'll vote on the bill. If not, we'll recess and come back. So, Senator Cohen, with that, I will turn this part of the committee hearing to you.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. Obviously, I'm not one of the stars you were referring to, but obviously, I have, as members of this committee know, I have a strong interest in the University of Minnesota, having presented before. But I think I can make an argument that there's nothing more important we might do this year then hopefully have this committee pass the appropriation as requested on behalf of the University of Minnesota, in particular for the University of Minnesota Medical School. And my job is just to kind of editorialize for a couple minutes and set the stage in a way that, to be blunt, these doctors won't do. They're not going to speak in a self-aggrandizing way. I can speak in the aggrandizing way relative to what they're doing at the university. And let me just take, I love to talk history. Let me take members back before any of us are around. Early 50s. The University of Minnesota Medical School is a top 10 school in the country. C. Walton Lillehei pioneers, probably, and the doctors can correct me, but probably along with Dr. Michael DeBakey at Methodist in Houston, cardiac surgery. And in fact, if you go to the end of the 60s, whenever the year was, 67 or so, Christian Barnard, who performed the world's first heart transplant back home in South Africa, was trained at the University of Minnesota. This was a truly remarkable school, did truly remarkable things. And for a variety of reasons, the medical school is no longer at that level. Part of that is the fault of us. Part of that are considerations at the university. There are a variety of reasons. But President Kaler has made an effort in bringing in Dean Brooks Jackson, who you've met before, to build up the medical school, and to do so with folks that are simply unparalleled in the world, not just practitioners that we can meet day to day. These are the folks who are trying to provide cures, not treat symptoms, but provide cures for significant diseases. We have with us today, and I should mention, Madam Chair, I had requested the CVs from these doctors, and they're not going to go through them. Members have them in the packet. And in fact, what I got was the condensed version of the CVs, which will just give you a flavor of how remarkable these doctors are. But when you hear them, you're going to listen to Dean Jackson, who came here from Johns Hopkins, arguably the best research medical facility in the world, and was enticed to come here by President Kaler with the expectation and the hope that we'd be able to build up the medical school to what it once was. We've got Dr. Douglas Yee. What Dr. Yee's working on is a cure for breast cancer, not treating symptoms, but a cure. Dr. Yee is from Detroit. Dr. Shacker, who actually is originally from the St. Paul area, is working on an HIV cure, but came back to Minnesota for the explicit purpose of joining the University of Minnesota Medical School. We have Dr. Badrith Kaneti, who came here via Sloan Kettering, but is originally from India. He's working on a cure for prostate cancer, and bladder cancer. And these doctors, though, are not only working on the cures, they're also treating Minnesotans. They're also clinicians who are providing amazing medical care to residents of Minnesota. But just to give you a slight flavor, and Dr. Kennedy, I hope I'm not misstating this, Dr. Kennedy and I actually met where I was consulting with him relative to a relative of mine. And when we were first talking, and this is about 4 years ago or so, 3.5 years ago, we were going to talk on a Wednesday because on Monday, Dr. Kennedy was presenting a paper in Berlin. We were going to talk on Wednesday afternoon, but because Dr. Kennedy had been out of town, he got caught up in clinic hours. So we agreed we would talk at the end of Friday afternoon when he was done presenting his paper in Palm Springs. That's illustrative of the fact that these medical practitioners are not just simply medical practitioners. They are the best in the world. And the reason for emphasizing that is they don't have the ties to Minnesota. Hopefully they've come to like Minnesota. They like our lakes. But they're here to find cures for these diseases. And these are doctors that if we don't provide, and it's not just a question of providing salaries for them. This isn't baseball free agents. But if we don't provide the research facilities, the labs, the residents, these folks can go anywhere in the world. They can go to Johns Hopkins. They can go to Harvard. They can go to the Pasteur Institute in Paris. They can go wherever they want. And the fact that we have them here, and these are only a handful of the people. For instance, we had hoped to have Dr. Wagner present who ended up being out of town. He's working on a cure for MS. So my question, Madam Chair of the committee, is does anybody here at this table know anybody who has had prostate cancer, MS, breast cancer, HIV? Because these doctors are working on cures, not treating symptoms, but working on cures. So I wanted to make the point that these doctors came to Minnesota and to the University of Minnesota Medical School to work in an environment that had the synergy, the support, and obviously the backing of the state, since it's the state medical school, to continue to do the kind of work they're doing. This is Nobel Prize quality work. And it's not that there aren't other research facilities in the world, in North America, in the United States, that are working on a cure for significant diseases. These aren't the only practitioners in the country. But in the attempt to build up the medical school at a level where we have, again, the synergy of these kinds of medical, this type of medical expertise available, one, in building up the medical school, two, hopefully at some point, you know, the famous story of Earl Bakken putting together Medtronic in his garage, hopefully the economic development aspect of that, but that's almost secondary at this point to the treatment afforded Minnesotans, to the opportunity to actually listen to the doctors who are working on these cures.
Thank
so I
you,
just
Senator
wanted to set
Cohen.
The stage and turn it over to the dean.
Thank you very much. And then thank you for your leadership.
So I'll just, Madam Chair, I'll just ask the dean and the doctors to come up here and I'll sit back.
Very good. Dr. Jackson.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Brooks Jackson, the Dean of the Medical School and the Vice President for Health Sciences at the University of Minnesota. Thank you very much for giving me and my colleagues the opportunity to give you an overview of the importance of the governor's proposal to invest $30 million in these medical discovery teams, allowing us to recruit 50 top tenure track NIH-funded faculty to the medical school. This is important if we want to elevate the stature of the medical school. If one wants a world-class medical school, one really does need world-class faculty. And this proposal, I think, will go a long way in getting us there. And I want to just give some examples of what does this mean? What will this money really allow us to do? And I think giving some of our own personal experiences and how this is done, I think will be helpful for the committee. As I mentioned, having teams of, say, 10 top faculty work on a problem. This is interdisciplinary, different types of faculty working to cure, say, breast cancer, prostate cancer, HIV. is really what is needed. It's very difficult to, these are grand challenges to try to find these cures, and one needs a critical mass to do that. And this funding will allow us to do that. My own personal example that I've experienced, I have worked primarily for the last 30 years on the prevention of HIV transmission, in particular prevention of mother-to-child HIV transmission. And when I started in this field 30 years ago, you know, there was no cure, there was no way to prevent HIV, and in particular, HIV mother-to-child transmission in this country resulted in 25 to 30% of babies from mothers who were infected becoming infected. They had a survival rate 50% had died typically in 18 months of age. I started my research, some of it in Uganda, where was the sort of the epicenter in the 80s for HIV. The hospital that I did a lot of my research, they had 36,000 deliveries a year there, of which 31% of the women were HIV infected, meaning there were some 12,000 babies being infected or mothers were infected every year there. So, you know, with working with a team of people, I started to collaborate with a number of people around the country. I've been at Hopkins for the last 20 years or so, but put together a team at Hopkins as well as internationally to investigate a number of new simple drug regimens that could prevent mother-to-child transmission, because we found out in our laboratory studies that most of the transmission occurs during labor, when the uterus contracts and pump some of that mother's blood into the baby in a number of cases. And so we found a drug called nevirapine that, if given in labor, was able to prevent the transmission during labor so that the baby would not be infected. This was working with, as I said, with pediatricians, with obstetricians, with pathologists, with statisticians. It takes a lot of people to try to come up with these types of major advances. We did find that it was very effective in terms of reducing the transmission during labor almost completely, such that the single-dose nevirapine regimen was highlighted and adopted by President Bush. And led to the support of the PEPFAR program, the Presidential Emergency Relief for AIDS, in Africa, and said that they would support programs that administered the single dose of nevirapine to the mother at the time of delivery and at least one dose to the infant shortly thereafter. That's a quote from President Bush in 2002, and since that program has been implemented, and with other additional drugs in addition to the nevirapine, there were, before that, some 600,000 infants being infected per year, 600,000 to 700,000. Because of this, it's been reduced by 300,000 to 400,000 lives per year are now being saved from this type of research. In Minnesota, I don't think we've had a case in years now. There are still thousands of people infected in Minnesota with HIV, primarily in the Twin Cities. But I think this is an example of team science that can really change the practice of medicine and result in many longer, healthier lives, not just for Minnesotans, but the rest of the world. So I give you that as one example. I'd like to have some of my colleagues give some of their examples as well, maybe starting with, to my right, Tim Schacker. He's the director of the Infectious Disease Clinic at Minnesota. He's a very innovative HIV researcher and is really focused on how we can cure HIV. Because I said we've got some good regimens to prevent mother-to-infant-child transmission and using some drugs. We still don't have a vaccine yet, which would be potentially a good area to look at. But we have millions of people who are infected and on drugs, but still it's expensive and no cure. And Tim is one of the leaders in the world in this area on looking at finding a cure. So I'll turn it over to Tim and give you some background on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to come and speak with you today. Just by way of background, I grew up in Arden Hills, just a little bit north of here, and actually went to the University of Minnesota for medical school about 1,000 years ago. And I trained on the West Coast, and then returned here. I was on faculty at University of Washington and returned here in 1996, primarily because of the opportunities that were here to continue my research. As Dean Jackson mentioned, my research is entirely focused on the question, how does HIV cause immune deficiency? But most importantly, and that's still a really relevant question, but most importantly, why can't we cure it with the tools that we have in our tool chest today? And to put this into context, we estimate that approximately 39 million people have died of HIV since this epidemic was recognized, and there are 35 million people infected in the world today. 1% of those people have access to the tools that I use in my clinic every day. So if you're thinking about a cure, if you're thinking about how are you going to intervene and do something, you've got to put it in the context of you're working in some of the poorest places in the world. So I'm interested in how does it cause immune deficiency and why can't we cure it? It's important to recognize that people who go on the cocktail, the drugs that I prescribe every day, they continue to have entirely abnormal immune systems. So if you go in and you study them, you continue to see problems. These drugs are not doing everything that people think that they're doing. One of the reasons I came back is because the University of Minnesota was at the forefront in the 90s of discovering what we call the pathogenesis. How does HIV do what it does? And it was at the University of Minnesota, one of my colleagues discovered that HIV is a disease of the lymphatic system. And so this was an opportunity to come. In fact, he made most of the sentinel discoveries about that part of the disease process. So when I came back, we began to look at a very novel part of the immune system, and we learned that HIV has an impact on the structure of the immune system that nobody had appreciated. We learned the mechanism of that. Why does that happen? We identified a target to try and prevent that from happening. We studied that in an animal model. We were successful, and today we have a drug trial going in humans to see if we can reverse that process and help restore immunity in people who are on antiretroviral therapy, the drugs for HIV. In addition, we've been really interested to know what is the size, how big is this problem, how big is the reservoir of virus in people who are HIV infected, and why can't we get at it with the drugs? One of the discoveries we made recently and published was that if you look at the concentration of drug in the tissue where the virus is replicating, it is significantly less than you would measure in peripheral blood where everybody is looking. So in fact, the drugs really aren't getting to where we think they're getting, and the drug that gets in there is not getting in at a concentration that'll kill the virus. This is a big problem in a cure agenda. It's an incredibly important problem. And finally, most recently, we've learned that the size of the reservoir, the number of cells that are infected, is orders of magnitude greater than was ever appreciated before. So you can have people who are on therapy for a dozen years, and we've done this study, and you can take them off therapy, and within 14 days, they're back to where they started before we put them on therapy. So what we've done is we've put the problem in check. We've stopped progression in many ways, but we haven't cured the infection. So the last point I want to make is that, you know, all of the work that I've been doing at the university for the last 20 years, I honestly can tell you I could not do anywhere else. When I came to the university, we needed to look in lymphatic tissue. The very first thing that happened was a group of surgeons came and said, I want to work with you. Let's work on this problem. The gastroenterologist said, we want to work with you on this. Fairview worked with us on how can we get this done in a most cost-efficient way. The biostats people, we work with them. Informatics, we work with them. This is a team approach. We routinely have people come to us and say, how do you do this? How do you get people to give all these lymph nodes? How do you advance the science like you've been doing? And it's because of culture at the university that we can actually get this kind of study done. We've been asked to come to Africa, to Uganda in the fall and bring my team to train a group of investigators in Uganda so that they can begin doing the kinds of work that we're doing here at the University of Minnesota. So with that, thank you for your attention, and I'll turn it back to Dean Jackson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Next, I'd like to introduce Badri Kaneti. Dr. Kaneti is the chair of the Department of Urology, and he's the director of the Institute for Prostate and Urologic Cancers. He holds the Doherty Family Chair in Uro-Oncology. Research is really focused on prostate cancer and bladder cancer. And so I'd like to turn it over to Badri to tell you a little bit about his research on finding the cures for these very significant cancers.
Thank you, Dean Jackson. Madam Chair, committee members, and Senator Cohen, thank you for this opportunity to address you all and enlighten you about our research. There's nothing more thrilling for a researcher than to have a captive audience, so I hope I won't savor this moment too long and bore you with it. I originally grew up in India, but most of my family is in California now. I trained at the University of Pittsburgh and then did a fellowship at Sloan Kettering. And before coming to Minnesota, I was at UCSF, which is in San Francisco. The weather is just like here today in San Francisco. But the reason I came here was, interestingly, all the people that had had a significant part in my training came from the University of Minnesota. The person who gave me my first job as a research fellow at UCSF trained here. The person who trained me at the University of Pittsburgh trained here. The person who gave me my first job trained here. All world-class scientists and surgeons, all of whom owe their allegiance to this university that really nurtured their careers. And for the longest time, west of the Mississippi, for urology, University of Minnesota was the place to be. And I knew coming here that we had a great history and we could rebuild such a program. My research actually involves prostate and bladder and urologic cancers. And just to enlighten you all a little bit about that, if you don't already know, urologic cancers, particularly prostate, bladder, and kidney, constitute the number one, the number four, and the number eight cancer in total numbers of all cancers. 25% of all cancers diagnosed in this country are urologic. That's one in four people have urologic cancer. So it's a significant health problem in the area of cancer. And I'm particularly focused on prostate and bladder cancer because they're very related. The reason I really was attracted to the university here is we were using a multidimensional, multidisciplinary approach to managing these cancers. We had fantastic imaging with one of the best MR imaging centers other than UCSF being centered here, and that attracted me a lot to coming here because I had the same facilities at UCSF, and I wanted to replicate that, and this was the only other place that could do that. We have a great group of industry here in town that you can actually collaborate with to come up with new devices and new agents that you can test and work with and develop for your patients. We're actually doing that with two different companies in town with new treatments directed at prostate cancer. We had new approaches and people within our own department here. There was one of my faculty members currently has made some key inventions in these areas and started major companies in town, and I would be able to get the opportunity to work with this person. And when I left UCSF, my chair told me, you know, we are number five in research funding in the country as a department. We'll probably go to number one. Why do you want to go there? I said, if you're already at the top, there's only one where we can go and down. I want to go to a place where I can actually bring to number one. And that's why I came.
Thank you.
Thank you, Badri. And next, Dr. Doug Yee, who's the director of the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota. He's the John Kersey Chair in Cancer Research, and his primary focus is on breast cancer. He's a clinician as well as a researcher and is chair of our comprehensive NIH-funded Comprehensive Cancer Research Center.
Thanks, Dr. Jackson. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for listening to us today. Senator Cohen was correct in that I did not have any ties to Minnesota until I came about 15 years ago, although I want to comment personally. I understand the value of state-supported Big Ten institutions. Well, when my parents came to this country right before World War II, my mother went to the University of Michigan and my father went to the University of Illinois. I think they met when my father decided to take a field trip to Michigan and check out the girls there. And so I literally owe my existence to state-supported Big Ten schools. I started my life as a physician, and I think as a physician and taking care of breast cancer patients, I was a little bit disappointed that we did not bring the science that we understood in the laboratory to the patients that we see in the clinic. I did my training at the National Cancer Institute, and the major focus was the idea that we should translate what we've learned in the laboratory into our patients. The first 10 years of my career were in San Antonio, where I helped try to establish the fact that there are many vulnerabilities of cancer cells, and we could potentially make drugs to those cancer cells and improve the cure rates for women with breast cancer. So I was attracted to the University of Minnesota because that was the tradition of research here, the tradition of research within the world of cancer, and particularly around the world of developing new therapies, was really based on the idea that we would take things that we observed in the laboratory, translate to them to the patients, and improve the outcomes. So I don't think any of us in oncology are happy with the outcomes we have today. Breast cancer, even though it's getting better, is still the leading cause of cancer in women, the second leading cause of cancer death in women, and we still have a ways to go. Drs. Jackson, Kennedy have already commented, and Shacker have already commented on the fact that one of the most appealing things about the University of Minnesota is the teamwork. I want to always emphasize this to you, and I hope you recognize this. We are very fortunate at the University of Minnesota to have all the disciplines on our affiliate campuses to deal with any problem. For example, one of my best collaborators now is in chemical engineering. This is somebody I would have never talked to when I was at the medical school in San Antonio because we didn't have any chemical engineers. If we need mathematicians to help us with problems, if we need people in the School of Journalism to help with messaging, we have everyone on this campus. My job as the director of the Comprehensive Cancer Center is to really make sure that all of our faculty understand how their skills can be brought to deal with the problem of cancer. I can tell you how collaborative we are, but I think you should recognize the fact that we are one of 41 comprehensive cancer centers designated by the National Cancer Institute, and the reason we are is because of the depth of our collaboration and the depth of our science. So we are externally reviewed every 5 years to make sure we are collaborating, and I think the greatest thing about the University of Minnesota is that's the culture here. That's what brought, I think, all of us here, and I feel very fortunate to be here. So I'll turn this back over to Dr. Jackson. So
just to sum up, Madam Chair, you know, the funding that's in this bill would go to support more medical discovery teams, much like you've heard about today. We are having putting in place an external process of top outstanding researchers in the country to advise us on those specific areas. You know, they are likely to be in areas such as neurological diseases, neurodegenerative diseases, probably cancer is almost certainly going to be one of those areas. There could be areas such as HIV, or it could be in other areas such as healthcare disparities. There's a lot of NIH money in that, and that's a big problem in this country and in Minnesota as well. So as I said, I think the key is getting these teams of interdisciplinary, top-funded researchers to address a common problem. That is how you really make progress, I think, in medical science today. As I said, we are not here just to optimize the current standard of practice, but to advance and cure disease.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Jackson, and thank you, Senator Cohn, for requesting this. I think it is appropriate. It's a little unorthodox before we roll out an omnibus bill to take this amount of time to hear it, but I think given the investment that we are requesting that this committee consider, I think that it was time well spent, and you are all inspiring, and every one of us around this table is in the presence of those who have been afflicted with the kinds of diseases that you are hoping to eradicate. And so we are all deeply touched, and not only that, but we have the honor of representing communities who we know are affected by the kinds of diseases that you are tackling. So on behalf of the committee and on behalf of those we represent, thank you for making this your life work. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Cohn.
Thank you.
So, members, we will now turn our attention to the proposed omnibus bill, and it is our intention to review the language, review the spreadsheet, ask questions, if there are members who have amendments, to take amendments, and then we will see if we are at a place where we can vote the bill out, which would be our preference. We've made sure that members had a chance to review the material, but if that's not the case, then we will reconvene tomorrow. We know that we're up in finance on Friday. So I would just like to make a few opening comments. I couldn't be more grateful for the members of this committee. If you look at the bill we've put forward, it is truly a compilation of the best ideas that have been brought to this committee and then the work of the committee as they've listened. I have found the committee members to be engaged, to be creative, to be demanding, to be forthright. And so bills come to us in one fashion, and they often leave much different. It's a very bipartisan, spirited discussions many times, and I think the result is something that we can be proud of. I would also like to take this time to honor and thank our staff. We are very fortunate. We're fortunate with our legislative assistant, our committee administrator, who both work tirelessly to serve the committee, and then our nonpartisan staff. We have John Fuller, our counsel, brings us his wisdom, his talent, and experience, and Maya Weidman works so hard and does an outstanding job with regard to making sure we live within the fiscal constraints and points out to us what our fiscal implications are. So having said that, before I turn it over to them, I also want to remind members that several years ago, it's already been like 3 years, we said that our three committee objectives were, number one, to reduce costs to students, number two, build a 21st century workforce, and number three, increase degree completion. 2 years ago, we instituted a 5% performance metric system whereby for the institutions we fund, both Minsk and University of Minnesota, we hold back 5% of our funding and do that in accordance with their willingness to achieve or to accomplish the achievement of, it was 3 of 5, we've now changed the formula a bit, which you'll hear about, 4 of 5 goals. That process has been collaborative. Senator Miller, Senator Clausen, and myself have negotiated those performance metrics with both systems, and we'll go through that as we go through the bill. And then finally, from the broadest perspective, the target, for anyone who does not know, was $205 million for our division. So we have before us, in essence, got some of the biggest pieces that you can listen to the rest in this context. We have supported Senator Stump's two-year tuition for technical college at no cost to those qualifying students. In addition, we have supported the governor's proposal to invest, we've said, $25 million in the University of Minnesota Med School. And then we have recommended a $60 million general appropriation for MinSCU and $60 million for the University of Minnesota, as well as making changes within the grant, state grant structure to serve more students, and we'll go through all of that. So I just wanted to lay that forward as the basic framework, and then we'll go through the details of the bill. So any questions before we begin that process? Okay. Mr. Fuller, would you like to begin by taking us through Article 2?
Madam Chair, members, I'm looking at the document. It says JCF Article 2-2 has a time of 9:14 on the left. It actually is a collection of articles, and what was done was, almost without exception, is to segregate each proposal as an article so it was more identifiable for you and understandable. And almost all of these articles are made up of bills that are mostly unchanged. There's only two articles that contain something that was blended in from another bill, and I'll identify that as we go along. So Article 2, because there's going to be a financial Article 1, is the sort of the residue of 1535, the OHE unsession bill from last session and this session, and we sent some of it along and retained some of it to give it further consideration. And so Section 1 is just an obsolete provision. You can see it refers to time past 86 and 87. The E-Verify in Section 2 is a provision necessary to engage in the refinancing program for OHE. What it does is it gives it an exemption because it can't be complied with, apparently, in the financial world. Section 3 was when we talked about it's the incentive for OHE. Turns out that they actually, if they don't do something like this, they have to spend money in other ways to do surveys. So it was reduced, I believe, from $25,000 to $10,000. You'll see on line 2.4. Section 4 is the state grant, child care grant. That was centered. That's one of the two bills that we blended. That was Senator Hall making individuals eligible if their spouse was a resident. That was brought in. So that's one of two. So Section 4 was Senate File 375. Section 4 is a child care provision. 5, 4, 5, and 6 are all child care. I suppose the key is on page 3.40. It sets the policy that the income eligibility threshold should be set at a level so you can spend all the child care money. So that's the principle that guides the rest of this language. The language is pulled out of rules, somewhat modified later on. You'll see the rules have been repealed. Section 7 at the bottom of the page 3 is a proposal. It has to do with the self-loan and the terms of self-loan. OHE has stated that they have money available, but they're not nimble enough to respond to the market. They can't package loans in a fashion that are attractive to individuals, even though they can offer competitive terms or better than competitive terms. So what this does is it takes out most of the language that sets the parameters of the self-loan program and lets the office set those parameters, maximum amounts, terms, interest rates. Because my understanding is there's several hundreds of millions of dollars that are going unused because they can't do that. Section 8 is, I believe that's ICAP. And what it does is most of the loans have been going in the metropolitan area. It sets a requirement that if there are sufficient applications, try to do as many outstate in dollar terms. Section 9 is the repealer that I mentioned. It has to do with child care that now in the statute in altered form. Section 3 is the Minsky presidential selection process, Senate File 1488. It was, as it was passed out of here, with two exceptions. One of the exceptions has to do with making sure that the finalists are really the finalists so that their names don't have to be disclosed. That would be the final process the board considered. And then a little tweak to the local advisory committee for universities because of the nature of their constituency. I don't know if Senator Miller wanted to say anything about that.
Madam Chair, Mr. Fuller, I think I'll wait for now, and if there are questions, I can certainly answer them later.
Article 4 is the
Page 8.
Is the campus sexual assault at Senate File 1300, Senator Benson. We went over it in committee. This is the version that came out of judiciary after it passed here, so it's the most current version. It provides for a great number of rights and obligations as to victims and to the campuses to respond to sexual assaults. It has a companion in the House. So this is unchanged from what passed out of judiciary at the last stop. Article 5 is at the bottom of page 16. Minsky timely completion of programs. This is the other article that blends two bills. It's 1620 of Senator Nelson on completion and strategies complete and goals of Minsky. This affects Minsky. And subdivision 3 there, one of the strategies is to reduce remediation, which has a number of strategies. And those are in subdivision 3 on page 17. So the overarching goal is to complete school. And one of the strategies, which we elaborate on in subdivision 3, is this supplemental instructions call, which includes remediation, prerequisite courses, development courses. Right. Article 6 is on the top of page 19. That's Senate File 2 that was brought to the committee by Senator Stumpf. it relates to Minsky. As a class of eligible folks, mostly recent or people who have graduated from high school right before the next fall, they can apply for a grant up to what the tuition and fees are at a two-year college if they're in a vocational program, which is referred to as a Carl D. Perkins program. And they get this grant would provide them the difference between other grants they could receive, both federal and state. On page 21 is Article 7. Used to be known as the pipeline bill. There is a change here. It's not dual track training. It's going to be administered by OHE, Office of Higher Education, and that deed may have been in the last iteration that you saw. Otherwise, the only other change is when you turn to page 23, there was blank as to what on line 11 and 12. That was blank, the maximum grant per application. So if some group or employer came in and wanted a grant, they couldn't get more than $150,000 as the state's share, and no more than $6,000 as the state's share for any particular employee. Doesn't mean it can't cost more, but that would be the state's share. Again, this program is designed to try to split between rural and metro area and places of employment. Article 8, study abroad. That was Senator Bonhoff's NFL 765. It makes some tweaks to the reporting requirements and what the Secretary of State has to post on the Internet. There were some changes, but they were inconsequential. Not inconsequential, but not significant. Article 9 is at the bottom of the same page. Research dog and cats, Dibble, Senator Dibble, Senate Bill 1841. When it passed last, it had a sunset date. If you go to page 26, line 7, you'll see that the substance of that bill is solely to repeal the sunset. Article 10 is Senate Bill 995, Senator Claussen, concurrent enrollment. Advice for a couple of separate surveys. I think the most significant, there's money for it in the bill, but Ms. Weidman will go over the money aspect of it, is on page 28, which requires that these concurrent institutions abide by National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnership Program standards. Formerly it was optional, so it's, but you can see it's pushed out quite a way before they have to do that. Or 2020-2021 school year. It creates an advisory board with respect to each post-secondary institution has these programs and provides for the appointment of the board. Section or Article 11, attainment goals. I don't think there was a bill for that, but I think we talked about it.
Yep. Mr. Fuller and members, this came directly from the results of the North Star Summit. We began our committee's work reviewing the North Star Summit in our first committee meeting, and the North Star Summit group in its broadest group brought forward requests that we memorialize our goals in statute. So what this does is they had four or five that they recommended. We took two of them, and that's what you have before you. Mr. Fuller.
On the bottom of page 29 is Article 12. We had a hearing on human subject research at the University of Minnesota. They made several public announcements about what their plans are and they're implementing them. This Article 12 is a reporting requirement. So we have three components. One is tell us what your plan is to address the general subject. On the top of the next page, you're required to say how you're going to implement those specific recommendations from that external review from the independent body, human rights participants. And then specific starting on 30.7 were the concerns, some of the concerns that were raised around the table. So the report must contain, in addition to two things I talked about, the changes to the institutional review board, give us some detail. We asked for detail on that. The procedures they're going to use when you have somebody with impaired decision-making ability as far as entering into human research. And then three, what their plan is to respond to the concerns of family members and others about the welfare of people in these programs. So that's, it's effective the day following final enactment. Those are monthly reports until they're done with what they're doing. Article 13, right there on the same page, summer academic enrichment. That's whenever you see 136A, that means Office of Higher Education. So it's Office of Higher Education program. Basically, there was a federally funded program that, for one reason or another, the funding was terminated. And this is for individuals in grades 3 through 12. The eligibility.
I'm sorry, I was saying.
There is one change, which was in the eligibility. It eliminates the requirement to have a certain grade point average.
Oh, right, yes. And we made that change in the committee, right. Yes. Right. And this is, yeah. It's actually my
change. The young, on the top of page 32, Senator Dahl, 1817. And it has an appropriation, Young Farmers Summer Seminar in Practice. TECOM program, you can recall there was, I believe it was Carleton College, and students, they would be involved in some farming internship, do that work, and some academic work over a summer period. And then there's a long section there of old language and new, and what that does is exempt on page 34, it says for the purpose of unemployment comp, these folks are doing intern work. They're not employees who can get unemployment compensation based on that internship. Article 15 is Senator Clausen, Senate File 713, student loan debt counseling pilot. That's a grant program, and it's the commissioner of OHE is going to make a grant to an institution, and the criteria is basically they have offices throughout the state and have experience in doing this. And the goal is that quick intervention, 30 to 60 days of default, they get noticed, and they talk with these folks, educate them, try to get them back on track in some fashion, and there's extensive reporting requirements. And there is money for that. Article 16 on page 35, spinal cord and brain injury grant program. Again, you see it's 136A. So Office of Higher Education is going to make three kinds of grants. Some business ones, and then they're related to traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injuries. Like I said, there's an appropriation, then there's an advisory board of highly qualified folks who are going to advise the Office of Higher Education on the grant applications. But it's the commissioner of the Office of Higher Education who's going to make the ultimate decision.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. How much is the appropriation for those grants?
And Ms. Weidman will go through that after, but I can tell you it's $1 million in the first year of the biennium and $1 million in the second.
Thank you.
On page 37, this was the Article 17, is the Kiffmeyer. Probably have to change the head notes, a little confusing, but basically it says that it gives eligibility as a resident for state grant and financing programs in OIG if you are stationed here and you're in the National Guard or a reserve unit. Article 18 is the parameters for the state grant program. Okay, and so there was one change here. This was Senate File 1194 on line 18.2. There's more than one change. And on page 18, line 22, that 95, the new 95 was 79, and my understanding is that was expensive. But so it's
38.22.
Yeah. You know what it says on that? Oh, yeah, 38. It's chopped on my.
Okay.
38.22, I'm sorry. So that's a change. And then the other changes were very small changes in the four-year maximum, $6. It went up. And changes in the LME, which went down by $30. See, it went down slightly. Article 19 is Senator Miller, 1613. In the last session, we had a bill that addressed this issue about the pathways. This is a Minscu provision from community colleges to universities, trying to make that pathway less bumpy. And there was a plan developed, and subdivision 1 basically says, implement that plan. We like it, you know, keep on task. And then subdivision 2 is saying, okay, for the Associate of Applied Science, which they have at the community college, try to develop some university applied science program so you get a BA degree in that area as well. So, and then the last article is Article 20. We had a goodly number of bills that trying to figure out what we should give students, who should give them what, you know, what this, you know, what information. And this, what this article does is it says, if you look on lines 39.30, you can see that institutions now participating in the state grant program, this is a state grant program, are required to submit enrollment, persistence, and graduation data for all students, including aggregate data, that's clause one. Number clause two on the next page is the job placement rate and salary and wage information for graduates of each program that is either designed or advertised to lead to a particular type of job. And three, the student debt to earning ratio of graduates. So this doesn't create any new reporting obligation, but if you look at the last 40.14, what it does is it distributes that information in a broader fashion. So it's be sent electronic form to school districts and workforce centers, and some advice is given to them about how to use it, but it's basically at their discretion. That's the end of it.
Thank you very much. So before we go to the spreadsheet and the corresponding appropriations, are there any questions on the Article 2? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about Article 3, Section 2, the selection of presidents.
The selection of presidents. Okay, gotcha.
So I remember our hearing. This was Senator Miller's proposal, and a couple of issues, members and Madam Chair. The first one is that this particular provision, the bill itself had to go to state government in order to deal with this provision, but obviously we didn't want to have the entire higher ed bill, and this provision then was referred to my committee to review it. So there are I have a question in terms of process, that this bill was not heard in my committee, and it was not transferred to higher ed. So in terms of process, I am wondering how it made it all the way to here. So that's number one. And number two, I just want the members to know that this particular provision presented a very interesting question for the Senate in terms of how is an unprecedented process of figuring out a new way of selecting, or in this case, it's really, you know, I have not made a big deal out of it because it's a recommendation. You know, we're not saying that college presidents now are going to be selected through an advisory committee. But this is new policy. We don't do this process. And so the idea of reviewing this and further, you know, trying to figure out if we put an advisory committee who will do a pre-selection or recommendation that then will come to higher ed and the institutions do it, it's kind of an unprecedented policy. So it was the estimation of some people that we probably need to have this conversation, figure out what is the precedent that we are setting in terms of implementing this, if we, you know, if this moves forward, if other, you know, if we will do this in the future, that we have advisory committees recommending, community advisory committees recommending presidential appointments. So all of that to me indicated that we wanted to have this conversation and that we wanted to talk about what are the implications. And then my understanding was that MNSCU that the institutions have been working with Senator Miller to really take into consideration some of the issues that he wanted to address and fix. So I would like to hear more about, you know, the two issues. One, the entire issue of process of how this language is now here when it just never passed my committee. And then two, whether or not we are ready to adopt kind of an unprecedented process in terms of presidential selection.
Thank you. And before I turn it over to Senator Miller for comments, Mr. Fuller, was there a comment you wanted to make?
Yes, Madam Chair, just to sort of put some context in. There is a rule that says if a bill appoints a legislator to, you know, a council, it's mandatory that it goes to state and local government. This didn't do that, so it was a discretionary request, and the discretion wasn't exercised. So it's not unusual if something just sort of disappears in a committee, it's not heard, it's not a yes or no, that it can appear in an omnibus bill. So that's not a sign of disrespect or anything. It's just, you know, it'll come up to the floor, the whole floor can vote on it. So there was not a mandatory reason for sending it there, and it was discretionary, and the discretion wasn't exercised. And so now it's not the bill that's in our bill. The bill stays there. It's the language has changed.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Soray. I am working closely with Minsky. In fact, I have a meeting scheduled tomorrow afternoon with a couple members of the Board of Trustees. So my hope is that before we have final passage of this language, we can come to some sort of agreement. But again, I'm still in conversations with members of the Board of Trustees. And as we heard in this committee just a few weeks ago, the current process that Minsky has and this process isn't a whole lot different. But as I explained it a few weeks ago, under the current process, there's a sense by some, and me included, that one person is in the driver's seat kind of throughout that entire process. And under this proposal, it gives the local advisory committee a little bit more authority. They're still not selecting the president. The final selection of the president isn't changing. It's still the chancellor and the board of trustees make that final selection. But the local advisory committee under this scenario has a little bit more authority when they're recommending those finalists to the Board of Trustees and the Chancellor, and this language states that the Chancellor and the Board of Trustees must select one of the finalists put forward by the local advisory committee or provide a reason why those folks weren't qualified for the position. So again, we are working on this, and my hope is that we will come to some sort of agreement before the end of session. And what I would ask for is the Board of Trustees to report back to us how they're going to change their board policy. The other concern that I have, and we learned this during testimony, is they really don't have a policy in place for the selection of presidents. They have it. They have a process, but it's not a formal policy. So one of the things that I'm going to ask them to do is formalize that policy. And that's sort of what we're trying to get at with this language here.
And Senator Torres-Ray, the concern I had as well was when we heard from Minsky, they basically said this is kind of exactly what they do. And I said, oh, could I see that, you know, where – what your policy is, and because it wasn't written, then I think it does leave room for the kinds of concerns that have been brought forward that went to this bill. So I have been supportive of the efforts of Senator Miller to work with the folks at Minsky to work something out. But go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do appreciate that work. I think that Senator Miller and you have been very thoughtful about the approach. I think for me, it's kind of a more pure policy question in terms of I'm okay with that work, and I'm okay with, in fact, amending the bill in the floor if that is not done. But this is the other way around. You're putting it in front of the policy that is unprecedented to push, and this is there, and you know, hopefully we take action on this bill because you work very hard to build bipartisan support. And then do we take it out? I mean, I am confused about the process that we are presenting to the committee. So my preference would be that this language is not there, that you do not implement a process in law that is unprecedented, and that hopefully you will receive this, and that if it is, and obviously this is going to come to the floor, and this will be the you know, they are fully aware of the fact that you've been working on this, and that the provision gets incorporated into this that is not pure policy, because I just believe that this is unprecedented and it should not be here. They should have that policy. They should present it to you, absolutely. And I think you've been working hard, Senator Miller, to do that. But having it in law, in my opinion, is an unprecedented process that we should not adopt. So I would like to remove Section 2 and make sure Section 2 and Section 3, and would like to pose that to the committee. I would like to move that as a
So, Senator Torres, we'll be taking amendments after we're through with Senator with Ms. Weidman's going through, and so you'll have that opportunity to offer that amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments on the what's been presented so far? Okay, Ms. Weidman, and I will a couple times during Ms. Weidman's presentation, I may ask Ms. Weidman to just stop and just review things that I think are important to clarify for the committee. So, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, I'll be working primarily off this landscape spreadsheet document rather than going through Article 1, which basically will just have the numbers in it and the riders. And then there is some performance metrics language, which Senator Bonoff will be reviewing with you. Also, there is a one-page document that basically, for the U, for the MNSCU, and for the Office of Higher Ed, summarizes all the appropriations for each of the years. And at the bottom, you'll see the total. Our target was $205 million, so you can kind of see where we're at in terms of the money that has been allocated so far. Also, in terms of going through the spreadsheet, I'm just going to highlight the programs where there were money was added to the base, and all other programs that are listed here basically are just at base level funding. If you look over on the far right, those two columns show you the change in the amount that the Senate is proposing. And how much that change is from the February forecast. So you can kind of see that. It's for both 16 and 17 and 18 and 19, and the two columns on the far right. We'll start with lines 7 through 9. This is a $20,000 per year increase for the Midwest Higher Education Compact. This is a dues increase for member states. Line 10 is a compensation adjustment for the Office of Higher Education of $36,000 in 16 and 73 in 17. And then you'll see the total in the column to the right of that. Lines 19 through 30 are the Senate's proposals for changes in the state grant program. The first is increasing the LME to $84.90. In the center, you'll see the costs in each fiscal year to make that change. It's a biennial cost of approximately $34.5 million for 16 and 17. The other changes are reducing the family responsibility for students without dependents, and also reducing the AFR for independent students with dependents. And if you'll see in the center, the cost of those two changes is approximately $18 million. And this is basically to get at, if you remember last year, we had the part-time student grants. This is basically a way to help those part-time students without having the part-time student grant program, but to do it within the state grant formula. Then if you go down to line 27, that would be a further increase of the LME to poverty level, which would take us to 88.28 in fiscal 16 and 89.04 in fiscal 17. The biennial cost for that is $22.6 million. Then we're increasing the four-year cap to the highest public, which is the U of M. That takes us from $13,000 to $13,626. That comes with a cost of about $11.25 million. The line 29 is, if you'll see the amount that gets appropriated to the U and MNSCU, you have to account for, if they're making an assumption of a 3% per year increase in tuition and fees. And within the state grant program, to the degree that that cost is not covered, you have to adjust for that in the state grant formula, because those individuals will get additional money to cover increased tuition costs. So that's just sort of a line to adjust for that. And then on line 30, we are reducing the family responsibility for parents of dependent students from 0.6 to 0.95 in the formula, and that's about a $2.2 million cost for the biennium. So basically, what the Senate is proposing is an additional $18.9 million in the state grant program of new money. Then we drop down to line 40, which is a $400,000 per year increase in the American Indian Scholarship Program, and this is to reduce the waiting list. There is always a long waiting list for that program. Then we can go over to page 2. Line 64 through 54. Oh, yes. At the bottom of page 1 is an appropriation of $1 million in each year for College Possible. Then we go over on page 2, lines 64 through 66 is an additional $116,000 each year for United Family Practice. This is money for family medicine residents. This would allow them to support increasing from 18 to 21 residents with the additional money. Lines 71 through 83 are various initiatives, bills that members have introduced. And again, in the center columns, two columns, you'll see the amount allocated to those initiatives. Line 71 provides for some grants to develop concurrent enrollment courses at $1 million per year. There's also money to expand programs that currently are in place, concurrent enrollments that are currently in place, $115,000 in each year. Then there are the dual training grants to the Office of Higher Education and DALI. The grants through the Office of Higher Education are $1 million in 16 and 2 in 17, and the appropriation to DALI is $250,000 in each year. The appropriation to implement the disclosure information activities is $50,000 a year. Line 76 is Senator Sparks' large animal veterinarian loan forgiveness program. That's a $500,000 one-time appropriation. Senator Hoffman's spinal cord research is there for $1 million each year. Senator Benson, the Office of Higher Education will have some responsibilities in terms of sexual violence and harassment reporting activities, and they've been given $25,000 a year to implement those activities. There's $300,000 a year for Senator Claussen's student loan debt counseling, $500,000 a year for the summer academic enrichment program, $24.36 million for the biennium for Senator Stump's vocational program, student tuition assistance. And actually what you'll see is although this money is appropriated to the Office of Higher Education, it will actually flow to Minsky students as an additional amount of money that they will receive in the state grant program. So you, in a way, you have to kind of add the 24.36 to the amount that Minsky is receiving, but it's just being channeled through the Office of Higher Education for administrative purposes. Then we have the Washington Senator internship at $100,000 for the biennium, $100,000 for the biennium for the Young Farmer Summer Seminar and Practicum. So the total new initiatives are about $34.5 million. There are no changes to appropriations for the Mayo Foundation. If we drop down to line 100, we have the student tuition relief at Minsky at approximately $59 million. We've got the ag teacher program. This is to develop programs for teacher preparation for ag teachers. This was a Senator Dames bill, $1 million for the biennium. And then there's also $200,000 for the biennium to develop online courses in the areas of agriculture. Line 104 was Senator Herr's bill for the program for foreign-born nurses, $100,000 for the biennium. The Metro State internship, Senator Torres Ray, $100,000. Then Minsky also has some responsibilities for sexual violence and harassment reporting, so $80,000 has been allocated for that. Senator Miller on line 107, his transfer initiative implementation at $250,000 for the biennium. Senator Sharon's Vets to Ag program, which is $150,000 in the first year and $600,000 in the second year. Line 109 is Senator Claussen's year-long student teaching bill at $175,000. That's a one-time appropriation. So the total change items there for Minsky are 61.37, plus you would add that 24 for the voc ed programs that is under OHE. Then we can drop down to the University of Minnesota, where we have $30 million in each. Then we have the $30 million in each year for tuition relief at the University of Minnesota. On line 126, you see the $25 million investment in the medical school. And then on line 137 is Senator Nelson's Alzheimer's and dementia research at $2 million for the biennium. So then if you drop down to line 148, you can see that if you go over to the far right column, the 204.955 total increase in the base overall for higher education.
So I wanted members to then go back to, and this is in Article 1. Now, if you would go to page 15, I wanted to just review what the performance metrics were for, we'll start with Minsky. And so here what we've said, again, is 5% of the fiscal year 2017 will be held back. And we've said 100% if the board meets four or five of the goals. If you recall, last time we said that if you got three of five, you got 100%. And if you didn't get three of five, you got nothing. And so as we thought about that, that didn't seem fair. And so there is a new formula proposed this year where it says you get 100% if you meet four of five, but then it gradually reduces based on what you've got, the amount of goals achieved. So 75% if three of the goals are met, 50% if two of the goals, 25% if one of the goals, and then zero of that five. And this is just of the 5% if none of the goals are met. So the first goal for Minsky is to increase by at least 4% in fiscal year 2015 compared to fiscal year 2008 degrees, diplomas, and certificates conferred. And there I would go back to when we said we were going to adopt those North Star Summit goals. The first of those goals was to make sure I'm sorry if you could direct me to what page that is on in Article 2 so we can cross-reference.
15.
So page 28, and the attainment goals in Article 11, it says the number of Minnesota residents ages 25 to 44 years who hold post-secondary degrees or certificates should be increased to at least 70% by 2025. So if we're going to hit that kind of goal, we have to make sure that one of our performance metrics has to do with the amount of degrees and certificates conferred. The next performance metric goal is to increase by at least 5% the fiscal year 2015 related employment rate for 2014 and develop compared to the 2012 rate for 2011 graduates. The next one for fiscal year 2016, The next one is for fiscal year 2016, reallocate $22 million of administrative costs. And the Board of Trustees is requested to direct those funds to invest in direct mission activities, STEM growth, and cost of attendance, and to programs that benefit students. So again, going back to our stated goal that we ask that our institutions really change the course of the cost equation with regard to delivering higher ed. The next one is to increase by at least 4% the fall 2015 persistence and completion rate for fall 2014 entering students who enter with academic deficiencies or remedial coursework. So as we look at the overall graduation rate at MNSCU, and many of us have expressed our concern around that, the group of students who are most at risk for completing are the group of students who come in needing to take remediation. And so rather than focus on the entire spectrum with a broad goal, we've narrowed our efforts to say, okay, we ask that particular attention be put on those students who are most at risk for not graduating, and that's what that goal is about. In addition, both the Nelson bill and the Claussen bill define both a request for a plan with regard to completion, and then the Claussen bill really lays forward strategies to accomplish that. The final fifth is increased by at least 5% the fiscal year 2015 degrees awarded to students who took no more than 128 credits for a baccalaureate degree and 68 credits for associate in arts, associates of science, or associate in fine arts degrees as compared to the rate for 2011. So again, we're saying we want these students to graduate without having to take extra classes, without incurring more debt, and so hence that metric. And so I want to acknowledge the group that worked on making sure the metrics reflect the committee goals and believe that that's a good plan, and really thank MNSCU for their work on that. So then if you move to the metrics for the University of Minnesota, starting on the bottom of page 18, on 1828, again is done in the same way, and the same formula holds through. And so number one, increase by at least 1% the 4, 5, or 6 year undergraduation rates averaged over 3 years for students of color system wide. So we haven't done that before where we've said we wanted to just again narrow down on the students who are most at risk, and so the students of color. And then instead of just looking at Twin Cities, which often has better outcomes than looking at it system-wide, this metric says students of color and looks at it system-wide. The second is to increase by at least 2% the total number of undergraduate STEM degrees averaged over 3 years. Number three, increase by at least 1% the four-year graduation rate at the University of Minnesota reported in fall 2016 over fall 2014. This particular metric was very challenging for the university because they traditionally report in 4, 5, or 6 years. But we believe that, number one, our students don't have access to state grant money beyond 4 years. Number two, any family who sends their child to a four-year university actually wants them to complete in 4 years. And so we have been very clear in our intention with this metric that we really want to begin having the conversation be about 1 year. So we've taken the percentage down but said let's look system-wide and let's focus on a four-year graduation rate. Page 12. We've got the reallocation of the administrative costs, $15 million. And then finally, the fifth one is to increase licensing disclosures by 3%. For both MNSCU and the university, before we talk about giving them the base appropriation in the bill, it says what they're requested to use that for. So we have not put a tuition freeze in our bill. Rather, we've laid out a broad agenda. So, for example, the Board of Regents is requested to maintain a low cost of admission and advance operational excellence to increase the diversity of the university's students, faculty, and staff, and strengthen the university's relationships with the agriculture industry and the communities of Greater Minnesota. Then we talk about how they should use the $25 million, and we lay out five different ways: increase their research capacity, improve NIH, the medical school's ranking in NIH funding, ensure the medical school's national prominence, invest in physician training, translate the medical school's research discoveries. So again, we believe the bill sets forward clear outcomes that we're tying to the funding that will accompany taxpayer dollars. The same thing happens for MNSCU, where we list on page 10 the Board of Trustees 10.23 is requested to maintain a low cost admission, develop timely completion strategies for all programs of study, increase the success rate for all students, and strengthen relationships with industry in the communities of Greater Minnesota. Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, maybe my memory isn't correct, but haven't these schools been operating under tuition freezes over the last few years? And if so, how long?
So 2 years ago, the Senate bill did not propose a tuition freeze. The House did, and when we accepted that position in conference, and the legislature did enact a tuition freeze for both MNSCU and the University of Minnesota. So we did not have a bill proposing a tuition freeze. You know, members can differ on that view. It is, and I've been pretty consistent with my belief that I believe the University of Minnesota should hold their costs down, and I believe they should freeze tuition. I believe MNSCU should freeze tuition. But if you say in order to freeze tuition, you need money from the state for that, then really you're increasing your tuition. You're just having somebody else pay that bill. So you're letting your costs rise, and then you're sending a bill to the state. And so I would suggest that we should invest prudently in the University of Minnesota, and we should invest prudently in MNSCU because it's our value and our commitment. And then we should demand outcomes and accountabilities, and they should keep their tuition in line.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't disagree with your reasoning, but I worry that the students end up with both. Right? That they're going to end up with the tuition increases as well, because there's no commitment from these institutions not to, and yet they're here to ask us for funds to reduce the costs of tuition, and we are doing that. But I just don't think we have any reason to expect that they are not going to also raise tuition. I'm very concerned on behalf of the students and the families that are trying to help their kids graduate that we don't continue that tuition freeze policy.
Senator Ortman, the University of Minnesota, in their original request, they asked for $65 million to freeze tuition. So I actually trust that with the amount we're providing, I expect that will happen. We can certainly call them to the table and ask them. MNSCU asked for $134 million to freeze. 142. Anyway, they asked for a great deal more to freeze tuition. I don't know where MNSCU stands with regard to that, but I hear you, and that'll certainly be a policy discussion. And again, you would be free to offer an amendment when it's time for amendments to this bill.
Well, Madam Chair, I would hope that if they want our support, these representatives from these schools will come and testify about their position on tuition.
Great.
To inform us about whether we need a tuition freeze or not.
Yep. So maybe if there aren't more, because I'm done with my presentation, if there aren't more questions before we take amendments, we could certainly call Mr. Fitzenreiter or Ms. King to the table and ask them their intentions with regard to tuition. Mr. Fitzenreiter?
Let me see them. Madam Chair, Senators, I'm Richard Fitzner, the Chief Financial Officer at the University of Minnesota, and I believe the question on the table is, given that we asked for $65.2 million over the 2 years to freeze both resident undergraduate and resident grad and professional tuition over the biennial, the two-year number, we're $5.2 million short. I will tell you that I agree with the chair of the committee. We'll go back and sharpen our pencils and take a hard look. Clearly, the president's priority in this budget is to freeze tuition. We particularly want to freeze tuition for both grad and professional and undergraduate. We'll certainly be able to do it for undergraduate with this amount. We'll sharpen our pencil to see what we can do to hold down grad and professional.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Nelson?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering if Mr. Fuller could just reiterate for me, what is the total appropriation to the U of M in our,
Ms. Weidman.
Ms. Weidman. On all lines, what is our total appropriation to the U of M in
Madam
the bill
Chair,
before
Senator
us?
Nelson, I think if you look at the one-page summary, you can see that the total appropriation there for the University of Minnesota is $87 million.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
That was my point, exactly, that it is well beyond the $60.5 million. And so I'm very highly supportive of the med school initiative. It's essential that we have our med school at our flagship university be a top-flight med school, so I'm highly supportive of that. But I did want to make sure that the record did accurately reflect that there's $87 million going to the U, and it was a request of $60.5 for the tuition freeze.
Thank you very much. And, of course, as the record reflects, that the additional $25 is for the med school, as Senator Nelson stated. So, Ms. King, if you could approach the table, please.
She had to step over to the house. She'll be right back.
Melissa Fanning, I hear the voice. I can't see, but I hear that voice. Ms. Fanning, could you please join us?
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Melissa Fanning, and I work with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Ms. King, our CFO, was just called over to the House Higher Education Committee to testify. She's actually speaking at the testifying table right now. So if it would be okay for her to come back and respond to that question in a few minutes, if that would be acceptable to the committee?
Ms. Fanning, you don't know the answer to that question?
To the tuition question?
Yes.
Madam Chair, members, haven't had those conversations since we saw the bill earlier today as far as what will happen with tuition. The $58 million that would be appropriated gets us partway, but not where we want to be in order to freeze tuition and not have a 3% increase.
And Ms. Weidman, if you could, the same question Senator Nelson asked for the university, could you review the appropriation for Minscu?
Madam Chair, members, the amount for tuition relief is 58.7, and for all the other initiatives is 61.37. But then I think one must also remember that there will be money coming over from the Office of Higher Education for the vocational education program, which would be an additional $24.36 million.
So we can really look at the 61.3 plus the close to 25, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So approximately.
So,
86.
Madam Chair, correct. We'd have approximately 86 million for Minscu.
Very good, Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Can you remind me again what the Minscu position was with regard to tuition? What was the number that you gave us previously that you needed in order to ensure a tuition freeze?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, the Board of Trustees is asking for $142 million in order to freeze tuition and cover inflationary costs, including compensation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
So we are about $60 million less than that. is your position that those $60 million in costs, some portion or all of them, will then be turned around as tuition increases to our students across the state?
Ms. Fanning.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, currently those conversations have not been had. We just saw the bill for the first time today, so we would have the board would have to take a look at that. But, excuse me, Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, the board's priority is affordability for students and asked for a tuition freeze.
So, Ms. Fanning, in your 142, the tuition freeze plus inflationary costs for other things, do you know what portion of the 142 was just your tuition related?
Madam Chair, I don't have that in front of me. I'm not sure. I apologize.
Ms. Fanning, Ms. Weidman, do you want to speak to that?
Madam Chair, members, it's my understanding that a 3% per year increase at both the state universities and colleges generates about $72 million.
So, Ms. Weidman, is it your view that just the tuition, so that's the inflationary increase or the?
Madam Chair, members, the inflationary increase would be the difference between the 72 and the 100. Or between 142 and the 72 or 70.
So about 70-something. So in that scenario, that actually the 86 would cover a tuition freeze, looking at it from that perspective. But I understand that you're not able to comment on the record on that right now.
Madam Chair, could you just explain that one more time, how the 3% is the $72 million difference and how that would help offset the tuition increases?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, basically the information that I got from Minsky was that if they increase tuition by 3% per year at both the state universities and the colleges, that generates that would cost $72 million. And that was what they would get in tuition revenue.
Madam Chair,
Senator Ortman,
if I could ask then, it's as likely as not that with that shortfall between the $86 million that we would be appropriating and the $142 million that there might be as much as a 3% increase in tuition for our state colleges and universities for the next 2 years.
Madam Chair, Senator, I guess I can't comment on that.
And I guess mathematically it would add up to the difference, and perhaps then some, but at least 3% would be needed.
Senator Ortman, I wouldn't jump to that conclusion because it's I think that there's a tremendous amount of community and market pressure for our higher ed institutions to hold their costs. And so that's been my position, is that if we let the market pressures and the student demand be heard, that in fact I think our institutions will find a way to freeze their tuition. And I personally think the Senate higher ed target is a generous target, and so it's my hope that the systems, both Minsky and the university, will find a way to keep their costs frozen within the confines of this appropriation. It's an appropriation that I really think fits the values and the priorities of the Senate, and so looks like a good number to me.
Chair, I completely agree with you that this is a very generous bill, and it's a bill that I am very much supportive of. But I am concerned, trust but verify. I want to hear from Minsky. I want to hear their commitment.
There she is.
It's a beautiful day out there.
Well, Ms. King, you're lucky to have gotten out because some of us have not.
We have an easy day. It's an easy one.
I was just over at the other body, Madam Chair. Pardon me for not being in the room.
Ms. King, we have asked that within the proposed Senate appropriation, we have proposed an additional $61,370,000. In addition, we are proposing the Senator Stumpf 2-year technical, which is 25 close to $25 million. And then also, it should be noted that we've made significant changes to the state grant program. So we've increased the LME. We have increased the cap. We have increased the assigned AFR number to send more dollars to students. So in essence, we are sending like $95 million more into students' hands with this bill, and a good chunk of that will flow directly to MNSCU. So I would look at this bill as actually a bill that you ought to be able to freeze your tuition, but that's the question that Senator Ortman's asking, is with this proposal, if we were to pass this year, would you freeze tuition?
Madam Chair and members, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Let me, if I might, just take us back a step and frame the response in the context of our budget request. Recall that our budget request was for $142 million, which would be sufficient for us to cover operating inflation on both compensation and other operating costs, and do it with state appropriations so that we didn't have to raise tuition. Because remember from the presentation we had here, I think just last week perhaps, we really only have two sources of revenue, state appropriation and tuition. And so the request that our board put forward to you was to support both of those and help us avoid a tuition increase. To do that, we need $142 million. So while your bill goes a long way toward that, and we're appreciative, it doesn't go all the way. And so I'm really not in a position today, having just seen the bill for the first time today and having not talked with my board at all, I'm not in a position to give you any assurances about tuition.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You were not present, unfortunately, Ms. King, when the chair of this committee was talking about what is, I think, a very generous bill with respect to higher ed. I think this committee is doing a lot. I think the budget target was a very generous target given our budget. I'm wondering how long it will take you to confer with your board and to get back with us and advise us about your position with respect to tuition given this level of funding. Because I'm pretty confident that the House isn't going to fund to the same level. And I think you've got an awful lot of support around this table. So I'm hoping you can provide some authoritative statement from your board in the next day or so before this bill is heard. To advise us about where we stand with respect to tuition and this level of appropriation.
Ms. King.
Madam Chair, Senator, I appreciate that, and I think I've already said that I appreciate the effort this committee has done with its target to respond to the higher education request of all the parties in the process. So if I didn't say thank you well enough or clearly enough, I apologize for that. I think it's improbable that I would be able to give you a board position in the next 12 hours. I think the board position as it stands today and tomorrow will hold with the $142 million request that the board put forth. And we would look forward to working with you as you do the best that you can in the days ahead to invest in higher education.
Ms. King, we're on the floor next Tuesday, and so I request that you do give us a board response prior to that. So, you know, regardless, I have my own belief with regard to state's direction on tuition freeze. So I'm not a chair who's going to support that, but I know some of my members will want to. And there may very well be the amount of votes to vote a different way than this chair.
I appreciate that.
And so they want that information.
I will do my best, Madam Chair. I will do my best.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Can I just set a little bit of a context, because, again, Ms. King was not present, but I just want to say I think MNSCU does an amazingly good job of helping Minnesota students get educated, and I want to continue that. And one of the reasons that your school is so successful, your schools are, is because they're accessible and affordable. That makes them successful, and I don't want you to minimize your success with these students or its accessibility to Minnesota students who desperately need this educational opportunity. So it's within that context that I am asking you today to go back to your board and ask for some kind of assurance about what will happen with respect to tuition when we make an appropriation of this size and how hard we should fight and work with our House colleagues to make sure that they support the Senate position here.
Madam Chair, Senator, I appreciate that very much, and I appreciate the support of this committee for the work that we do all across the state. We, of course, share your belief that it's life-changing, very important work for all of our 264,000 students. So thank you for that.
Thank you. And is there a Minsky trustee in the room? I've seen Regents, but I don't know if I've got a Minsky trustee. The Minsky trustee is here. Please.
Madam Chair, there are no Board of Trustee members here today.
Thank you. Okay. Very good. So we want to open up for amendments, but more comments first?
Just a brief question.
Oh, Ms. King. Ms. King, there's more questions.
My question has to do with the interaction of the state grant. So we've talked about the increase in state grant caps, alimony.
Yes.
And my question is, does someone have the how much, what percent of the state grant typically goes to Minsky students?
So, we do have an overall sheet that Mr. Kornacki will pass out. But if Commissioner Pogamiller or Marin could join us at the table to. He left?
The other place.
Oh, he left at the. Marin, please. So the sheet that you have before you does not just include the increase. It tells us in its entirety. And so you can see. How much does go to Minsky? Yeah.
So I added them to 662. Yeah. I did just 2 year and 4 year.
So it was approximately $140 million. Was in the Minsky 2 year, 4 year. So, comments, Ms.
Madam Chair, Senators. Unfortunately, Ms. Fergus is also in the House, who would be the content expert on this question. But I know that she did update this document today, so she could have renewed numbers. And I am willing to call her, able to
Please
call
do.
Her and have her come over in the next 10 minutes, if that
That'd
works
be
for
great.
The committee.
Thank okay. you. So, members, if we could put aside the state grant detail, Senator Nelson, if we could just put it aside for 10 minutes, because Ms. Fergus really should be in the room to answer these questions.
Yes, I'll withdraw my question until she's here.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Mine is on a little different subject. If we want to leave this for just
yeah.
a minute, I have
yep.
one clarifying question for Ms. King. If she's still here, did they have to run again?
Ms. King? If you, Senator Sharon had a question for you.
I was just curious to know. I'm reading reading the appropriation for the transfer initiative implementation that is in this bill. It says the implementation must, to the greatest extent possible, be done in accordance with the implementation plan, including its timeline, et cetera. Can you, without much going off and researching, tell me, what does that mean? What can I expect to see to improve the baccalaureate transfers? This has been something plaguing us for a long time. I'm hoping we're going to have a performance measure on this in the future at some point.
Well, Senator Sharon, I think the performance metric that says you have to graduate with 128 credits for a four-year and no more than 60, whatever it is, for the two-year is the metric that's associated with that, because the only way to get that done is to accept the transfer credits. That's the biggest reason why they have so many credits, is because of that issue.
Because they have... There's all sorts of confusion for the students. I just continue to hear that this is
yes.
not resolved. So I'm interested if I could hear
yeah,
responses
absolutely.
To why this is not improving and why we continue to try to figure out a way to get this to happen in the Minsky system.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, thank you very much for that question. The committee was presented a report, I think like February 15th, if I recall the date. There was a report provided to the body of our strategy for pursuing transfer improvement across the system. And that report has a program of actions and some deliverable deadlines that is what I assume this language aligns with. But again, having just seen the bill today, I haven't had a chance to run around and talk to everybody. That's my understanding of it. And in that plan, we commit to creating transfer pathways for four programs this year or by December.
This year.
By this year, and I believe four more a year from now. So we're completely aligned with your interest. It was one of the work groups that came out of Charting the Future, and this was the first work product that came out of that group because of language that was in session law last year calling for a plan. So we've submitted that plan to the Senate, and that's what this language would help us implement.
And can you help me,
Senator Sharon?
Can you help me remember how those eight programs were selected? Are they the most frequently utilized by students, or are they driving students towards a particular field?
Hello, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Parker, representing MSCSA. I was part of the team that created the transfer plan. I'm also its president-elect for next year. Actually, it's for the first year, it starts off with four, and those four were chosen by our team looking at the most popular degrees, because our big goal was we wanted 25 to 30 of the most popular degrees to be universally transferable, because there's so many different types of classes out there, and that's where we saw a lot of transfer issues. And on top of that, we chose degrees that we wanted to fit the AA, the AS, and the AFA. So we specifically chose, we took out theater, we took out biology, psychology, and then business, because we wanted to have a broad range of those popular degrees that for this first year, as kind of a trial run, get all the kinks worked out, make sure everything worked. Those why those degrees were chosen. After those four degrees are their transfer plans completed, and then they are rolled out into implementation, it'll be up to the various bodies of MNSCU and the transfer pathway teams and the various bargaining units involved to decide which degrees are next based on their popularity.
I think, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, you've identified the approach we took to this, which was to concentrate on the pathways that were the most credit producing, which means we would affect the most students to make the biggest impact early.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions of members? Senator Nelson.
Did I miss the answer to my question about percent? What percent of the...
We were holding off till Ms. Fergus is here.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and she's coming. She's on her way.
Oh, thank you.
So I have an amendment. We're ready for that.
Let's get started.
So I have what's the number? JCF 13. So while it's being passed out, I'll just give you a brief overview. There has been a kind of a late decision, which is why this is in an amendment form. The University of Minnesota realized that they could save a great deal of money by refinancing their TCF bonds for the stadium. And so they spoke to MMB, and it turns out that within our statutes, they don't have permission to refinance their bonds. So we actually would need to provide them with that permission. Mr. Fitzenreiter was working with Senator Stumpf, thinking that that permission would go into a bonding bill, thinking that because it was related to the bonds and therefore would need a two-thirds majority. MMB let Mr. Fitzenreiter know that that's not, in fact, the case, that a simple majority was all that was required. And so we have chosen to make sure that that actually happens. We've chosen to put the language within our bond or within our bill, and that's what's being proposed here. In addition, Senator Stumpf had talked to the university because he had planned to put it within his bill, and said that he requested they use $10 million of the savings towards the design of a new research and education facility for the University of Minnesota Med School and Clinic. If we're going to be investing, you know, $25 million, or as the governor requested, $30 million into the University of Minnesota Medical School, we cannot have facilities that, in fact, aren't state-of-the-art, aren't in keeping with best practices, or we're not going to get those researchers. And so this directs the university, which they've agreed to use $10 million of their savings for the purpose of designing that building. And then, if you'll look also, that we do add language that we say that education and research facility will be co-located and designed to maximize collaboration and high-quality delivery of healthcare. And we know they would do that without our saying that, but we wanted to make sure that if we were going to carry it within our bill, we wanted it to reflect the intentions of the Blue Ribbon Commission as it came forward. So I offer this for your consideration and would ask members' support to include it in our overall omnibus bill. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the total savings to the university should this bond repayment and refunding take place?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Madam Chair, Senators, just by way of background, these bonds and this legislation was, these bonds were sold in 2006, 2008, I think, is that time frame. And the legislation allowed the university to issue that debt. It's not direct debt of the state in the sense that we, the university, issued it, but the state provided a $10.25 million annual appropriation of the university in statute to retire the bonds on that debt. That deal included the university transferring to the state in exchange for that $10.2 million over 25 years, 2,850 acres of land in Rosemont, Minnesota, that became part of Vermilion Highlands. So there was a complex financial transaction that occurred that was a win-win for the state, for DNR, for the public, the university, the Gophers. And in my wildest dreams, I never thought at the time when we issued that debt, and we issued it for about 4.2%, that we would have a great recession and interest rates would drop to the point where, just coincidentally, we're at almost the 10-year call period on those bonds. We're within 2 years, and interest rates are sitting right now that we could issue that debt at about 2.5% for the remaining period.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing. And the savings that the university would accrue over that remaining roughly 16 and a half years is about, it always depends on when you're in the market. I can't get in the market tomorrow on these. It would probably be this coming August. Want to get in before the feds do anything. But it'd probably be in the neighborhood of $40 to $41 million. By doing this $10 million project, the university will likely debt finance that $10 million, because we got to spend that now. That'll cost about $13 million in debt service payments of the savings, leaving the university, if this legislation was adopted, with about $29 million or so of savings, a great deal of which occurs annually over the next 16 and a half years.
And members, I apologize that I didn't get to each one of you before the committee. I got to many of you. I actually kept looking for you, Senator Peterson. You were with Senator Rust on the floor, trying to tell members ahead of time, because it's not was not my intention to drop this at the last minute. But it was really just discovered that Senator Sumpf was not going to be carrying it, and it was moving over here. And so Mr. Fuller has been working with Mr. Fitzenreiter, trying to make this all work, and Mr. Nauman and Ms. Weidman. So that's why you have it before you now as an amendment. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple more questions on the bonding side of it. Which is this a typical that should the university refinance its bonds or reissue its bonds? that it needs to have legislative approval, or is that just because these are the bonds that are tied to the TCF stadium?
If, Madam Chair, Senators, it really was the way the original legislation that authorized the university to issue the $137 million and receive the $10.25 million, that we just didn't put a clause in that would allow us to refinance without coming back to the state for that permission.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson. And
so that would be explain why we've not seen this type of thing before. Normally, the university can refinance its bonds without coming to the legislature for approval.
Madam Chair, Senators, that's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions on that? And by the way, there is a quorum present. Let the record reflect. Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, thanks. The original authority granted to the university was how was that done? Which committee committee or committees authorized that?
Mr. Fuller.
Well, Madam Chair, it went through a number of committees, but it was not in the bonding bill. It was a separate bill. It went through higher education. That's where it started. It went through finance. It was changed. And then it went to conference committee with the House. Where they had different provisions. So.
And so it didn't, Madam Chair, it did not go ever go through the Capital Investment Committee initially?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, I don't believe so. I worked there. I don't remember being there. Capital Committee doesn't meet very often.
Okay. So, Senator Claussen.
Madam Chair, I move we adopt Amendment JCF-00013.
Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Is there, has this committee taken testimony on the Medical School and Academic Health Center project in general?
We have not. That's why we actually had all those doctors here today. But we have Dr. Terry Bach here to address that. But that, knowing that this was coming forward, and he's here to talk about it. But we had the Blue Ribbon Commission meet. Actually, we did. We had a whole hearing about it. We had the Blue Ribbon Commission report, and they recommended this. And then we had the governor's proposal where he recommended the investment, and we had the doctors here today.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yep.
Madam Chair and members, the Blue Ribbon Committee endorsed, as part of its work, two of the most critical facilities issues that we're facing in the medical school and the other health sciences. One is just the quality of the clinical research facilities we have. And so if you're going to actually deal with clinical research, you need faculty, facilities, and patients. And so that having the kind of facilities that are state-of-the-art, that are competitive with our national and the international peers is just really critical. So part of the facilities would house a number of the new faculty that we would be hiring, but it also would allow us to increase our clinical research activities of the current faculty, as well as in the conversations we've had, for instance, with a number of private industry. They are interested in partnering with us to be able to bring a number of the clinical research that they have contracted to other universities back to Minnesota. So I think there's probably a strong economic development aspect to that, too. The second most critical need is, in fact, the state of our educational facilities for the medical students. Most of our educational facilities are over 40 years old. They're worn out. They don't actually deliver. We can't deliver today's curriculum or the future curriculum in the current facilities. So this would be planning money for us to take a look at for what we need to replace, what we need to remodel, and to be able to actually be able to train medical and other health science students together in modern facilities with simulation labs and active learning classrooms, and to be able to tie research and education and patient care together.
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, and my intention is not to rehash the hearings. I take comfort in knowing that given the late nature of this amendment that there has been a process and is going to be a process that will make sure that this
very
has
good.
Been and will be vetted.
Yep. And it's been interesting that we have this session spent a good deal of committee time on the delivery of health care because of the importance that the 40% of the overall budget of the university goes towards that. And so I think we, as a committee, have given it a great deal of focus, and rightly so, and we began with Senator Claussen's medical debt relief bill. So hopefully that'll be moving somewhere else. But thank you. So Senator Claussen renews his motion. Mr. Fuller.
We're putting together a spending bill, so the formalities are a little bit lightened up. So as we assemble the bill, you notice there's no page and line in here. So generally, usually give an instruction for the staff to assemble everything that's been, you know, adopted into a bill, which I assume is Senate File 5.
Right.
So
that's
the understanding you usually have, because we're, you know, that's how you put together an omnibus bill.
So Senator Claussen's motion is to direct staff to adopt. He moves to adopt the article, and then the action would be staff would incorporate it. So, Senator Nelson, did you have a comment before we voted on that?
Yes, I did, if I could make it at this
point.
Please
do.
I was wondering if this additional $40 million in net savings by the refinance, I know $13 million of that is tied to the pre-design, but overall $40 million of net savings for the U. I'm wondering if that can help further ensure that tuition is held down. That was my point.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, good catch, Senator Nelson.
I didn't want that question.
You know, I will tell you that when you plot this out on an annual basis, after paying for the debt service on the $10 million, the net savings to the university on an annual basis is in the early years of this, but I got to structure the debt.
Yeah.
Is in the $250,000 to $300,000. A lot of the savings comes late, not timed this biennium, later in the term of the payments.
Thank you.
But as I mentioned earlier, we're committed to work hard to do what we need to do to freeze tuition.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So all those in favor of the Claussen motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion's adopted.
Madam Chair, I just want to thank you for this. I apologize for the lateness. And your patience, but thank you. I think this will be another win-win for the university and the medical community as well, that we get that project moving. Thank you.
So, Mr. Fitzenreiter, unfortunately, I think the real heavy lifting is going to happen in conference. So
yes.
let's hope that these kinds of provisions prevail. Thank you. Okay, so other amendments, committee members. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment. Oh, and Ms. Fergus is here now, right? But we'll do the A1 amendment because we started, and then we'll go to Ms. Fergus. But I hope she doesn't get called back in the meantime. So if she does, we're going to... Okay, they're done. Okay. Go ahead, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A1 amendment is language that intends to move forward a recommendation that came from the governor in the governor's proposal. And this language is regarding the Pell Grant reduction in the calculation of the state grant that was proposed at the governor's bill to support some of the young students for whom this particular portion of the federal money is not there, you know, for them. My understanding is that, you know, this is a very small amount of money that needs to be in place. You know, this is a small number of students. And these are remarkable students that really have made it to a point where they meet all of the eligible criteria. These kids have all the credentials that are necessary to attend our institutions. Yet this funding is not available to them, and therefore I would like to ask members to support these students and to incorporate this into the Senate bill. So that's what the A1 amendment does.
Gotcha. Senator Peterson?
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if staff could identify United States Code Title 20, Section 1091, what you were talking about, I've heard reference to these students. Could you just talk a little bit about that student population?
Yeah, Mr. Fuller?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson. That's the Title 20, Section 1091 is eligibility for federal financial assistance for post-secondary students. Clause, and this is a list of people who are not eligible for Pell. A5 is non-citizens, and I believe D is non-high school graduates.
So, members, just to review, last session, we passed, last budget bill, we passed a bill that said if you went to high school in Minnesota and were applying to our colleges, you would be, number one, eligible for in-state tuition, and number two, that you would have access to state aid just as any other Minnesotan high school graduate. And so we passed that bill, and we were really one of, I believe, four states. Many states have said the in-state tuition is comparable, but only four states at the time, and it could be that now many more have passed it, I don't know, but one of four states who made the state aid available to that same population, and that was something I strongly supported. I do oppose the amendment because I think the state grant program, we in Minnesota have reached out to that population, made sure that we are doing, treating each of our Minnesota students equally. The federal government hasn't made that choice. So with regard to the bill before you, the Stumpf bill, which is free technical school to low-income and middle-income students who qualify, that population, we don't have any requirements around. I mean, if you're a Minnesota student, you're eligible. Same with the Earn While You Learn. We know it's so important, and the business community stands with us. We want to educate these students, and so we're trying to create programs to make sure that they have access to high-quality education. I would ask the University of Minnesota, who is somebody who's here from them, to come forward and tell us what their position is. You know, when somebody gets into the university, qualifies with regard to meeting their financial need, and I would ask the not-for-profit privates to come and tell us the same. And the reason why I'm asking them is because that there, you know, I want to understand what really we're talking about here. So could I ask somebody from the not-for-profit privates as well as somebody from the university to come forward and address meeting unmet need with this population? And this is the omnibus bill. I figure every sector should have people here, so I'm surprised how hard it is to get people to come to the table. Hello.
Yes, Madam Welcome. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cirkvenik, president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I'm happy to come to the table. And I want to say thank you for, again, making good investments in the state grant program in the bill you have before you today. If I understand your question, it is how do our colleges try to meet the financial needs of undocumented students? Is
Please.
That correct?
Yes.
Okay. The needs of undocumented students present a real challenge, and there is not, I don't think, a universal single approach that our 17 members take. Each school designs their own financial aid policies in the ways that work for their students and their institutions, given the resources they have, and those resources vary greatly among our 17 institutions. Having said that, I will tell you that I think generally two things would be true. Our schools are trying hard to serve those students, and they are doing it mostly
with their own institutional aid, very significant amounts. I would tell you that on average, our students pay less than half the published price, and low-income students pay far less than that. And most undocumented students fall in that low-income student category, and they're getting very, very large financial aid awards from our colleges. But they don't have unlimited resources, and so I'm sure if they were here, they would tell you they can't meet all the needs of those students. They can't meet the needs of all of the needs of any of the needy students they're serving. All needy students have a gap that they're meeting by borrowing or by gifts from extended family members or by working three jobs. All the things students do who are really committed to getting an education.
Thank you. Senator Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the testifier. Can you tell...
Mr. Cervenek.
Cervenek, excuse me. Can you come back? Can you tell me if you have the data on how many of these students are you seeing coming through the door? Because from just anecdotally, I know they're having a hard time to afford any even two-year colleges. So I don't think they're, like, coming in droids, is my point. So I want to know... From your membership, how many students are we talking about? Do we have that data? Because it is a concern. We did remove the barriers of access to in-state tuition costs, but we still haven't removed the financial burden. And I've talked to students in programs, after-school programs, that are thinking, okay, we have 2 years to be able to go to school through the executive action by the president. So now... we still have to go to work first because we can't afford even a two-year college. So I'm just skeptical that you have a ton of these students, so I just want to know how many are we talking about in your system.
Yeah. I don't think we have a lot of students. I wouldn't want the committee to think we do. The numbers in our sector are growing, and our financial aid staff have indicated to us that the changes made to the state grant program last year have increased the level of interest among immigrant students, both undocumented and documented, because there's a greater awareness that there are some financial resources available to help them get to college. But we don't collect specific numbers about undocumented students. And so I can't tell you the numbers, but I would say they are small.
Is somebody from the university prepared to come forward? I saw Pierre was here. If not, I've seen Chair Beeson in the room. Chair Beeson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Rick Beeson, Chair of the Board of Regents of University of Minnesota. I'm really not prepared to answer in any detail, but am willing to... get a response and get the data and information the committee would find helpful to respond to Senator Torres-Ray and Senator Franz's questions.
So, Chair Beeson, it's my understanding that when a low-income student is admitted to the University of Minnesota, that the university does all they can to meet their unmet need. And that, in fact, you're looking to expand the amount of students of color and low-income students, that's something that's a stated objective. So do you know, is there a differentiation in terms of meeting unmet need between students in the category that they're talking about?
Well, Senator Bonhoff, members of the committee, it is a priority for the university to serve low-income and students of color. We retain 93% of our students of color from year one to year two. We are also the lowest cost provider of tuition for families under $30,000, public or private, in the state of Minnesota. But is there need for additional dollars? Yes. There's incredible need for additional services, and it is just a constant project.
Thank you. And as I understand it, Ms. Keel is on the phone with your financial aid people to give us more detail.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, if I could just to summarize what this amendment does, maybe a little bit more succinctly. So what we're proposing to do here is to utilize the grant program to make up for a public policy decision at the federal level.
Exactly. That's the amendment. Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Weidman, can you provide any kind of a financial implication that this would be?
Madam Chair, Senator Klassen, I don't have that information, but I believe Ms. Fergus has perhaps done some runs and would have the answer to that question.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, I'm Meredith Fergus. I'm the state grant analyst for the Office of Higher Education. And I'm sorry, I was answering an audience question while you were speaking, so I missed your question.
What would it cost if the Torres-Rae Amendment went on?
I believe, Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Rae, that the amendment mirrors what was in the governor's proposal, and we estimated that cost at $5.2 million over the biennium.
Got it. And Senator Torres-Rae?
Madam Chair, I am curious about how this calculation is being made, because my understanding is that we don't have a real number of the students that actually come to this. So I would like to ask a follow-up question as to how the calculation is being made.
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Rae, we do have application data on 2 years of DREAM Act students now. There were approximately 620 students who applied for the DREAM Act in this current year. We used their actual financial aid financial information to calculate the Pell Grant they would have qualified for had they been eligible to receive a federal Pell Grant, and so that is how we were able to determine the number. We did also build in some enrollment increases because the DREAM Act is drawing more undocumented students into higher education. Not a huge increase, but a slight increase.
Senator Torres-Rae.
Madam Chair, to the testifier, it is my understanding that this number is completely unprecedented, that you did not have, if you could give me a sense of past years, and this has to do with the fact that we have the federal changes, so there was a kind of a wave of students that came in, but this number is not a number that is a typical number. Am I correct on that?
Ms. Fergus.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Rae, you are correct. Prior to the implementation of the DREAM Act, we had no way of estimating how many students would be impacted. Even with the numbers we have now, if the student does not approach us or complete the application, we don't really have an estimate. So I can't tell you how well we're serving the population that could qualify. All I can tell you is if we were to fund the population that did apply. Does that make sense?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I believe Ms. Keel is ready to address the University of Minnesota's practice.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Christine Keel with the University of Minnesota. If a student is a Minnesota high school student and they are DREAM eligible, they are treated as any other Minnesota student.
That was my understanding.
For scholarships, yep. Grants, and U-Promise.
Yeah, that was my understanding. So, members, I don't have the $5 million within the budget that's before you. Somebody would have to, you know, make a proposal to change the numbers. It would throw the bill out of balance. It's my belief that with the stump provision, with the actions of the others, that we're talking about a very limited that it's a change. The changes we're making in this bill will go a long way to addressing this problem. So again, I don't support the amendment. It didn't get put into this bill. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to confirm that the population that Senator Torres-Rae mentions in this amendment, they are eligible. I think you mentioned this. They would be eligible for
the
free community and technical college as long as they qualify.
The technical college. Yeah, that's
The technical, the 2 year. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Or staff, can you, I'm having a hard time finding it again. Which line is the stump provision in?
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, if you look on page 2, it's line 81.
Thank you.
And just for members' review, the stump bill just says that if you graduated from high school and you meet the income requirements, then you would be eligible. And so really the rationale behind supporting that is that we have a huge skills gap in the marketplace, and we have particularly in rural, and I guess they don't like rural, greater, whatever, Minnesota. I don't know how you want to call it, Senator
Sparks. I'm
sure
we call it better Minnesota.
That we have companies clamoring for these technically trained students. And so this this provision really is aligned with making sure that our students get that training. Yes, Senator Klassen.
You know, just a point, I believe, if Senator Stump's bill goes through and we're offering free tuition, these students can also apply for the Minnesota Grant for Living Expenses. So I think that there's a great deal of
flexibility.
Aid and flexibility that's being applied in the situation.
Well, and the some fill those last dollar in, so they qualify for the state aid, and then it would be active. Yeah. So, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I support Senator Stump's bill. I think it's a good bill and addresses this issue, too. I would change the characterization of Senator Peterson in terms of being a public policy decision at the federal level. We did pass the DREAM Act at our state level, so this is in line with a decision we made 2 years ago to support DREAMers. We just didn't fund it. We didn't provide this level. We didn't fill that gap that they don't qualify for Pell grants because we can't change that. That's federal. So I feel like this is aligning with what we've already done as a state. But I do believe, we're moving in the right direction. But I see this in terms of the skills gap and the workers gap. We have it, and a lot of these students are still deferring school because they can't afford it, and they're not in a position to be with families that could help them afford tuition even at a two-year college, and I'm seeing that over and over again. So there is a need, and 620 students, it's not that big of an ask in my opinion. And in terms of our budget, I think it's aligning the policy with what we did in a couple of years ago. So I support the amendment, and I hope we can find a way to fund it, if not this year, soon thereafter.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just draw, I think, what is an important distinction between the two things, which is our actions, both in the Stump bill and the DREAM Act and others, were decisions that we made on our own, viewpoint and values for the state of Minnesota. It is, I think, a distinctly different idea to peg our public policy to a federal decision and then attempt to compensate for what is federal policy. I do think there is a distinction there, and I think that not only is it important in this case, but it's an important precedent in a whole host of public policy areas where we could go down the same road. And so that's what I think the difference is between those two items.
Thank you. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Franzen's point, I do want the record to reflect that we did fund it at the state level. And if 620 students applied and received funds, I think that's a great thing. I supported the DREAM Act, and hearing that number, I think that was higher than what we expected, higher than what the estimates were. So I think that's a really good thing that 620 students were able to take advantage of that. That wouldn't have been otherwise.
And the in-state tuition as well, which was a good thing. So Senator Torres-Ray renews her motion to amend Senate File 5. All those in with the JCF Article 2. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail. Next amendment. Another amendment? Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I have the A2 amendment.
Madam Chair?
Yes, go ahead. I just remembered we were going to call on Meredith Fergus, but now we'll do it after this one. Go ahead. It's before us.
Madam Chair and members, I would ask you to consider the A2 amendment. We have had some pretty extensive conversations in this committee about remediation and some very troubling testimony from Minnesota students who came forward and said that they were paying the costs of remedial education in our colleges and universities. To the extent that one young lady was here after having gone through her ninth course of remediation. I know you all remember that testimony. It was a very powerful testimony. And the burden of paying for the costs of this remediation has unfortunately fallen on the students. There is a terrible gap in our system where we are providing publicly funded education, K-12, to the extent that we do, and yet we are graduating students who go to our community colleges and technical colleges and then are unable to meet the standards expected at a college-level course. And so after having visited with a few of the members here in this committee who shared those same frustrations, I would offer the A2 amendment, which would then create a warranty, if you would. What it would do is say that if these students have graduated within 5 years and present themselves to one of our colleges or universities and they are required to take remediation, that the costs of that remediation tuition should be sent back to our high schools if it's within 5 years of that graduation. Members, this is a proactive amendment. It goes forward beginning with students graduating May 1st, 2015. And rather than asking our students to pay those costs, that diploma should mean something. It should mean that they are prepared to take on college-level courses. There is a protection here that if these students, after the remediation is identified as needed, our high schools can then go back in and demonstrate that these students did in fact attain a college-ready level while they were in the high school. What this would do is allow our state colleges, universities, and the University of Minnesota to go back to those high schools and ask as a just claim for the cost of those tuition. I would much prefer that than asking these students to pay the costs of this remediation. I think we've done a lot to create an incentive for credit-bearing remediation. I think that was a great first step here, but I also don't think that the cost should be borne by these students. So I would ask members to consider this amendment, the A2 amendment, as one that's much needed. A strong message is needed to be sent to these high schools that we expect more.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a fiscal note for the amendment from, I would imagine there'd be a significant cost for the K-12 system, obviously a higher ed as well. I'm just wondering if that's available.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, we do not have a fiscal note on this, but I would say in response to Senator Peterson that, the amendment is proactive going forward May 1st, 2015. These students and these high schools have the ability to go back and look at their programs, their curriculum, which I found to be not strong enough, not challenging enough for our students, and there is still time for them to adjust to make sure that they aren't sent back a big bill. But I think it is time that there are consequences for our high schools that are graduating so many students that still need high school education when they leave.
Senator Ortman, last year or 2 years ago, the head of the student group put forward a proposal similar to this, and Senator Weir, well, I carried it and then I withdrew it because of my concern about the logistics and the cost, and then Senator Weir carried it and it didn't go anywhere, but I applaud the thinking behind it because I think we're saying we want our K-12 system, when they graduate our students, and now particularly when they all take the ACT, and we're going to see where students are, we want those districts to be accountable for student outcomes. And so I see your bill or your amendment as addressing that. And I agree with you. In fact, I've been a strong supporter of both Senator Claussen and Senator Nelson's bill. The biggest policy change within this whole bill is on remediation, and we've changed our metric to actually focus on remediation. I, though, can't support the amendment without having had it heard in K-12, without having the districts had a chance to come forward, without having a fiscal note, and without knowing the financial impact at this late date. So I would ask, you know, we'll see what the members say, but I would ask that you carry the bill next year and make it known.
Madam Chair, if this bill, if this amendment is not adopted today, I assure you I will introduce a bill, and we can go forward with this proposal. But I also wish that today this committee would send a very strong message back, not just to the higher educational institutions that we are really troubled at the fact that they are asking these students to pay this tuition, but also that we are very troubled at this huge gap between these graduates from our high school. It's bad enough that we have such a high non-graduation rate among our high schools. I mean, when you look at what's happened here with how many students are not graduating, and then you add in the number that are graduating but don't have the skills that they need to succeed in college, it is a terrible gap. And so I would ask committee members to join me in sending that strong message. And I think I would hope you would include it today and consider whether or not we would want to take it out on the floor. But I would ask for your vote today. I think it's time that we step in and say these committees don't work in vacuums. They are not silos. We have to take what we get from the education committee. We don't serve on that committee. Some of you may, but I don't. And I'm seeing this huge gap, and it is up to us as legislators to begin to address some of those gaps. This is one of those huge gaps that needs an answer.
And Senator Ortman, Senator Wieger hears every bill, and many of us are on that, so he would have heard it. But, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two comments. One, we're assuming a 12th grade reading is the standard, and I'm not sure we have any type of research that shows that. I would say probably students entering our two-year community technical colleges are not at 12th grade reading level, but that doesn't mean that they can't be successful, earn a degree, earn a certificate. The second thing is that we're assuming that all students are equal. We're not taking into any account that our graduates coming out of high school have different ability levels. A student that is a C-minus high school math student may have to take remedial courses. Now, does that mean that, you know, the school is to blame, that they got a C-minus in high school math and now have to take a remedial course? So I think there's a lot of other conditions that have to take place that you have to consider. I kind of look at that comment about, you know, this isn't Lake Wobegon. Not all students are above average. We're not taking into any consideration that there are differences. And that doesn't mean a student can't be successful and can't graduate with a degree or with a diploma and be successful and earn a living in Minnesota and have a good job. So I just have some reservations.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. And then Senator Torres Wright.
Madam Chair, I understand those reservations, but I have also heard that students, and I know from my own experience as a parent in the public school system, that a second math isn't required, and the English courses aren't being given a grade. They're given pass-fail. I'm very troubled at the fact that our curriculums are not as rigorous as they should be, and that is part of this problem.
Senator Torres Wright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that Senator Claussen brings up a very interesting point. I am very appreciative of this conversation, because if the requirement for graduation says that there are, you know, if they meet this requirement, they can go on to pursue some careers. One of the problems that we have is that the door is really not wide open to pursue those careers, because there are just a substantial number of students who have to pay right now for remedial courses. So if we have a student who's graduating who met the prerequisite yet that student still has to take these remediation courses and pay all of these money, then the option for that student to take other classes or graduate in other careers is truly not an option that is open. I don't know if I'm making sense, but so Senator Clausen said, well, there are some kids that don't meet these criteria, yet they can be successful. Well, that's the question we are asking here. No, they are being asked to take remedial courses and pay thousands and thousands of dollars that they could have paid to pursue a degree. I hope that Senator Stump's proposal opens the door for some of these technical careers that may offer an opportunity. But in the current system, I think Senator Orman is correct to say, if we're going to require that they meet this prerequisite, and if you don't, you take all of these remedial courses, I think it's a disservice to the students because, no, Senator Clausen, these options are not open to all of the students. They could, but they don't. They have to pay for remedial courses, thousands of dollars, impeding them to pursue those degrees that, you know, I don't know, they should be open to them. So somehow we do have to send this very strong statement that it is not okay for the higher ed institutions to accept students and get them into this, you know, requirement to pay thousands of dollars, and then they don't have a career. They just didn't use the resources to obtain this training that is needed for them to get into the labor market.
Thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Orman and Senator Torres-Ray, I agree. That was why Senator Clausen and I co-authored Senate Files 1407 and 1408, which went directly to the high school graduation and having the Commissioner of Education and the Chancellor of Higher Ed determine what are minimum proficiency standards for a four-year, a two-year, and a certificate program. And unfortunately, Madam Chair, those were not heard in education, even though a hearing request was made. So we've been trying to address this issue, and this seems like a bit of a blunt stick approach to it, but we do need to do something, and you know, I don't think it's a big expense to the state as much as it's going to be a local impact.
Yeah, low. Thank you, Senator Nelson, and then Senator Eakin.
Madam Chair, I missed part of the discussion here, but let me just say that this is not a new discussion. And the fact that we have 40% of our high schoolers who graduate and are not ready for college. Now, that's 40% of our current students who take the ACT, and that's not even every student taking the ACT. That's under the model last year. Only 40% of the college-bound kids who take the ACTs in our state are actually ready for college. Actually, it's 39%. I was being generous. And that is, in general, that's not even disaggregated by different groups. So it is incredibly difficult for us as a state to move forward when we have so few of our high school students ready for college when they graduate. But I've had this discussion on at national conferences as well about this very issue, and usually the second statement that comes back when this comes up, maybe it's already happened at this table, is that, well, if you want the K-12 system to pay for the remediation of the kids they graduated that weren't ready for college, the typical response is, well, send us better teachers. Oh. So they will say, well, the problem is the higher education institutions are not sending us teachers that are equipped to make sure that our kids are actually graduating.
Sounds circular to me, Senator
Nelson. It is a very circular argument, but that does not take away from the fact that it's a serious issue. But yes. I do agree with Senator Pratt that this might be a very good amendment to offer and have this discussion about, because I think it's an important discussion. But I do think it might not be an amendment that I could support right now today.
And I would ask the committee members, I know Senator Eakin's next and then Senator Clausen, but I would like you to look at on page 18 what's actually in the bill on this subject, because we have really, I guess we start actually on page 17 with the Nelson bill, where we tell them they have to have more completion, and then we say replacing developmental or remedial courses when appropriate with co-requisite courses, and then we tell them they have to report back on it, expanding the proactive advising, developing the meta majors, making available alternative mathematics curriculum. One of the things I always say is, why, if a student wants to go into some technical field, or if a student wants to go into real estate or into this, should they have to take calculus? Why can't they take the math that's appropriate and relevant to them? Somebody who couldn't pass that kind of, you know, no. I had a math issue. But in addition, we have the Supplemental Academic Instruction Bill that Senator Claussen worked so hard with the Minsky folks that really details very clearly that we want change in this arena. And Minsky's not happy. Minsky gave us a very large local a fiscal note that they say it's going to cost them to implement the strategies that Senator Claussen's put forward. And then there's a very robust report that is required at the bottom of page 18 where they have to tell us how many students went into remedial, how many of those completed, how many of them did the co-requisite. So we're going to have a spotlight shown on this in a very unprecedented way. I'm sure anyone who's been following this knows that this committee is really deeply concerned about this. And so I want to thank Senator Nelson and Claussen and the committee for saying that we won't tolerate this, regardless of what happens to your amendment. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then Senator Sharon. Oh, then Claussen and Sharon, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do think this is an issue that needs to have the spotlight shown on it, and I think Senator Ortman for bringing the amendment forward. It's an important discussion. And I do have some concerns, however, and Senator Pratt, you mentioned it being a rather blunt instrument. I was trying to think of how this is going to affect the decision-making at the local schools. I see the possibility that some schools may just decide that they're just going to start failing the students and failing them out so that they don't have to run the possibility of having to pay for remediation later. That to me is just pulling the plug on the students when we need to make sure we get them up to speed. So I think sometimes we need to look at maybe a better way of incentivizing the schools to actually get these students up to speed and not, you know, see them just pulling the plug on some students.
Thank you. Senator Claussen?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of things. The requirement for math is 3 years in the state of Minnesota for high school graduates. But if you look at the statistics, I think it's 26% of our total students who enter our colleges, universities, public, take remedial courses. The vast majority are at the two-year institutions. I think it's 1% at the University of Minnesota system that need to take remedial courses. What Senator Boniff pointed out that's in the bill, we really need to look at a systems change. And she pointed this out. If we're going to have a student to be trained and get a certificate in a computerized milling machine, what are we doing having that student take a college algebra course versus learning in front of that machine the math that he needs to know or she needs to know to run the machine? I think we've got a system that's failing students. And it could be at some point secondary schools too, graduating. But I think if you look at our college system, our two-year college system, I think that we've got a system that needs to change, not necessarily an issue with blaming people. We're causing failure in these students. And this bill, the requirements that we put in it, hopefully is moving in the right direction.
Senator Sharon? And then let's vote.
Well, I just would add, I think I draw from both perspectives here. I agree that the that is a system change that has to occur, that the admission criteria, the acceptance of students, this happens in law schools too, that they accept students whether they are capable of doing the work or not. They let them come in and take some classes, take that money. They rely on that money to support the rest of the system. Even with knowing the risk that these students are going to drop out, they're going to drop out, so they underwrite their system on dollars that are they know ahead of time are not going to be achieving an outcome. And that's what we're talking about here, that these are students that so I think, you know, when what needs to change, we have this assumption that everybody, once they're out of high school, ought to be allowed. You know, in the Minsky system, it's everybody come, we take all. I think we ought to take a look at that assumption, that that's the position we ought to be taking. Because with that, we do lay the responsibility for resolving this issue on the higher education system. And I don't know that we need to blame, but I really am not supportive of all of these initiatives that we have to take through the higher education system to resolve this issue. I do think we need to become much more distinguishing about what the obligations and competencies are that a student needs to have to take various kinds of programs. But even to come in to take general eds, there has to be a certain level of competency. There is to get into the higher level of education, 300, 400 level courses. You have to have a certain GPA to get into it. And if you can't achieve that in the sciences and nursing, you just don't get into the program. Even if you do, you don't get in because the slots are so few. So I really am very concerned that we continue to see this as something that has to be resolved in the higher education system. And I don't agree with that. I don't know. I don't say that to say I'm blaming the K-12 system. But we ought not be letting students or asking them to pay for courses in higher education that are not moving them towards a degree or a certificate. And we ought not, I don't believe we should be asking higher education system to resolve this problem.
Oh, I was mentioning to Dave sitting next to me listening to the discussion, I said, imagine if our committee got to do the E-12 bill for a little while. Wouldn't we have fun with that? I would trust this committee to do some very good policy design and implementation, because I really have great respect for every voice around this table and think that with our demand for high standards, our commitment to each and every student, and our what the members have brought forward, we've done some good work. So with that, you want to renew your motion?
Madam Chair, I would just like to say that I think the spotlight is on this problem right now among committee members. And I think the number itself, the fact that 26% of these students at our state colleges and universities are needing some form of remediation, should be an alarming number for every member in this committee and everybody hearing this testimony or this conversation today. But with that, I can see the writing on the wall here. I'm going to withdraw the A2 amendment with the assurance that I will work on a bill for next year, and I would ask members of this committee to join me as authors.
We'll be your
on
co-authors.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Fergus, thank you. Come sit down. Senator Nelson asked, what percentage of the overall state grant dollars goes to the Minsky system, and the dollars?
Madam Chair, Senators, are you talking for the most recently completed year under the base budget or under the proposed Senate? Under the Senate proposal.
Senator Nelson.
My question is, right now, under current law, what percent of, or I should say current actualities, what percent of state grant funding goes to students who attend a Minsky institution?
Madam Chair and Senator, let me look that up for you. It is on our website. I did calculate it for the base going forward for next year as well as the Senate proposal, but I will look up the actual for the most recent year. If you'll just give me 1 second. It is a statistic we commonly get asked, which shocks me that I cannot remember it.
Can't retain statistics. I have to look them up over and over.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, it is on page 13 of the state grant end-of-year report. For fiscal year 14, approximately 21% of state grant dollars went to Minsky two-year institutions, students at Minsky two-year institutions. 16% went to Minsky students at Minsky four-year institutions, 26% to students at the University of Minnesota, 29% to Minnesota private nonprofit institutions, and the remaining 8% to Minnesota for-profit institutions.
Thank you very much.
And Senator Nelson, it is on this chart that we have in front of us.
We waited a long time. We have a lot of papers here, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Any other questions? Oh, Senator Miller, did you have a question for Ms. Fergus or a comment?
No, I have a general question.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Fergus. Any questions for Ms. Fergus about the proposed changes? Everybody, Senator Sharon.
The second part of that is, what do we anticipate the changes in these percentages to be with the new formulas that we're utilizing?
With our proposed Senate. Thank you, Senator Sharon. That's what I wanted to know.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, under the proposed changes in the Senate budget, the amount going to students at Minsky two-year institutions would increase to 22%. The amount to students at Minsky four-year institutions would be 16%. The University of Minnesota would be 25%. Private nonprofits, 30%. And for-profits, 7%.
So the overall Minsky would be 36%. And that does not take into account the 22 at the two-year and 16 at the four-year.
38%.
But
38%.
I told you I had math issues. No, but I was very good at addition, so that was just sloppy. But anyways, Ms. Fergus, that does not take into account the Stumpf bill either.
You are correct, Madam Chair. It does not take into account the other proposals before you.
Okay, good. Senator Miller.
I'll wait till the end, Madam Chair.
Okay.
So after amendments.
Any other amendments, members? So if there are no more amendments, then Mr. Fuller is going to take us through the appropriate motions. Yes.
Madam Chair, before we do that, I'm wondering if staff could, we talk a lot about the additions to base funding for MinSKU and the U of M. I'm wondering if staff can just tell us what the, if this proposal were to pass, what the total amount would be allocated for both MinSKU and the University of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Senator Miller, so you're asking for the U for MinSKU?
Just those two, and maybe the state grant program, what the total funds would be.
Madam Chair, Senator Miller, if you look at, let's start with the state grant. Looking at line 35, there is basically an additional $18.9 million that is being put into the state grant program. But then we are also spending approximately $74 million because there is, with the projections that were done for the need for 16 and 17, there is additional revenue that we have to work with of about $78 million. So if you see on the bottom line, we'd actually sort of be spending about just shy of $93 million, which would be the $74 million of underspending plus the additional $19 that we're adding.
Right. And, Madam Chair, so what, not the total addition, but the total, the base plus the addition amounts for U of M, MinSKU, and the state grant program? Total.
If you look at...
I just want the record to reflect that. We talk a lot about, Madam Chair and members, we talk a lot about the increases. So, for example, a $60 million increase to U of M and 60 to MinSKU, but we don't often talk about the total amount, all funds that we're spending. So the base plus the addition.
Madam Chair, if we look at line 89, the total for... the Office of Higher Education for the biennium would be about $504 million. If you're looking at... Did you see that?
That's fine. And then, okay. Then and the U of M and then MinSKU.
If we look at MinSKU, you'll find that total for 16 and 17 on line 116. Of a biennial total of about $1.3 billion. And for the University of Minnesota, this is just general fund dollars, it's just $1.284, which is on line 142.
So, Madam Chair and members, if this proposal were to pass, roughly Minsky would receive about $1.3 billion from the state of Minnesota, and the University of Minnesota would receive about just under $1.3 billion in general fund dollars.
Madam Chair and Senator Miller, also if you look at line 148, you'll see there's about a $3.1 billion overall of spending for higher education.
Thank
That's
you.
That's base plus new.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Miller, for the question, because I do think that we operate from biennium to biennium looking at increases rather than looking at what is the state truly investing. And so I would go back to the comments that I made to Senator Ortman earlier and Senator Ortman echoed, which is that I believe that this is a very generous target, and that I commend the committee for the work that we are maximizing the dollars in a very targeted way to really begin to, in my opinion, create a sea change in our approach to delivering higher education. We have done so in setting forward many different strategies, putting in place accountability, investing in the U of M Med School, allowing our students to have as much choice as possible within the dollars that we have. And so, again, I thank you very much for the work in putting this bill together. So the motions before us would be to adopt the various articles. So, Mr. Fuller, could you... Oh, I'm sorry. Testimony. I apologize. All those people waiting. Anybody who would like to testify?
Let's go.
For or against the bill? Now is your time. Jesus. Commissioner Pogemiller. I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm here because the governor has requested that all the committees hear from the departments before they pass their bills.
Thank you.
So thank you for affording that opportunity. Just very briefly, first, the governor's general impression would be he would like to see your target at $288 million rather than $205 million.
Yep.
So with that in mind, though, based on the target you do have to work with, your bill does follow the general outlines of the governor's initiatives and progress and kind of balance that the governor had in his bill in his recommendation for tuition relief, investment in the state grant for our lowest income students, and important medical research and medical research preeminence at the University of Minnesota. The focus on recalibration of the state grant and helping independent students for your increased $18 million is greatly appreciated. Obviously, the governor would like to see an extra $25 million in there to help middle-class students also, and perhaps the Senate can move there in a conference committee. The committee is recognizing Senator Claus and others are working on research-based strategies for improving retention and completion. That's Article 5, basically. That work and working with Minsky, we think is very, and I think the governor thinks is very timely and good work. Senator Bonhoff's dual training or learn to earn, which one are you preferring now?
Earn while you learn.
Earn while you learn. We also think research is research-based and that it helps retention and completion, incent students to study and work in the field that they're interested in, and it helps in this work-study trade-off for students where they have to choose between working or going to school full-time. Senator Stumpf's second-year vocational program emphasis on research-supported mentoring and support services we think is absolutely right on target. Senator Dietzick's proposal, even though this was not in the governor's proposal, for summer academic enrichment we think is absolutely a good investment, the governor thinks is. Your work in sexual assault, I think Senator Benson is leading that effort, is very good work, and it seems like you've worked with the campuses to come up with something that's reasonable in terms of reporting, and we want to continue to work with you to get it so they can report easily. And then finally, the Lucian Social Services Student Loan Counseling Program we think is very well thought out and should be helpful to help students avoid defaults. And then finally, Madam Chair, my staff wants to thank you personally for including, by and large, most of the policy bill that they worked on so hard 2 years ago. And we thank you for doing that.
And Commissioner, as always, we thank you and your great staff for the service they provide.
Thank you.
If approach the table, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Matthew Roderick. You may recall from me meeting with many of you. Essentially, really just wanted to say thank you for including the spinal cord injury, traumatic brain injury research grant program. Just briefly, 6.5 years ago, my son was injured, and my hair didn't look like this. I stopped cutting my hair because I told him I wouldn't cut my hair until he got out of his chair. Aww. So I stopped combing it as well. So while you're looking at my hair, I want you to think about the last 6.5 years. In that period of time, there have been significant advancements in the field, and that's why we're here. It's sort of a serendipitous coincidence, I think, that the esteemed members from the University of Minnesota were here to talk about cancer and HIV. We're here because, in essence, the researcher that talked about HIV, in the last 30 years, the reason why there is such a reserve of knowledge infrastructure and collaborative infrastructure is because those activists from that community worked very hard to get to the point where now there's an NIH annual expenditure of $3.4 billion. There's a lot of money in that research. They are 1.5 million people, just as our community of spinal cord injury is 1.5 million people. So we are doing exactly what they are doing. And we wanted to thank you for that, and thank you for listening to us and hearing us. We may be back and see you again.
Well, we hope we'll see you when you report back as well, and we hope that your hair will be combed and looking very different because he'll be out of the chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rob Woodlick. I live with a spinal cord injury. I'd like to thank you as well for this inclusion of this bill. I just want to briefly say that this will definitely, this disease-specific funding will definitely give the best ideas of the state. That's what we're here for, and we want, you know, as far as spinal cord and brain injury go. And that's why we're here. And, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else like to testify in support or opposition of the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Christine Keel with the University of Minnesota. And I'm here on behalf of the university to say thank you. We appreciate the tuition investment in particular, the investment in the medical school. I think they're a perfect example of why that's important. So thank you.
Thank you. Ms. King.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. It's hard being behind a pillar. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to address the committee. I've had a chance now to catch up with the conversation that happened while I was out of the room. We appreciate the effort that's gone into this bill and the willingness of members to work with our staff as ideas were developed, and we hope there to be a continued commitment to that effort. To the question that I think you asked earlier about base consequences in this bill and what we imagine our board's reaction to be, I would just want to make one observation for you so that you understand how we think about the bill. If you look at your spreadsheet, what you see here is $58 million for tuition relief, and we compare that to the $142 million that was in our request. Senator Stump's bill has no impact on our resource requirement because it's simply replacing a student-paid tuition dollar for a state-paid tuition dollar. But it isn't a contributor to our revenue requirements. So from our world perspective, the bill has $58 million of the $142 million request that we put forward from our board. So as you're doing your math and thinking about the base consequences, just know that that's the way we look at it. We look forward to having continued opportunity in conference committee to work with you.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. That was one other thing I forgot. Also in your bill is the performance language.
Mm-hmm.
And I would characterize us as being not supportive of that language. It is true that you invited us to participate in the drafting, and we shared with you some very grave concerns we have about the language. We are certain that were the language to go forward the way it is, that we will have budget cuts hitting our campuses. And we want to make sure members understand that.
Yep, Ms. King, I am surprised because we did have a session together. We made a proposal. You came back with comments. We addressed your comments in kind of a next round sort of document and said we hope you'll accept this, but never heard back. And so I don't understand that. That isn't what happened with the other body. I don't understand that.
Madam Chair, we did respond. Thank you for the opportunity to review the first draft, and we replied with responses to that draft. Mm-hmm. And then your staff shared with us your response to that and indicated to us that that was the end of the conversation. So we did not understand ourselves to be invited to continue a discussion. I apologize if we misunderstood.
So I think my words probably were said, I'm sure were repeated as I said them, which is I hope this will be the last round. And so it doesn't mean I thought it would be. I hoped it would be. So I apologize if that left you with thinking the door was closed, but the door is never closed.
Terrific. We'll work with you then. Thank you very much.
Thank you. At this point, though, I think we're going to pass. No. The door might be closed now.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Roger Arntz, and I represent College Possible. We deeply appreciate the appropriation that's in the bill here for College Possible. We're going to track this through the process. We appreciate the confidence that you demonstrate and that this appropriation demonstrates in the programs, and we plan to do very good things for kids, both in high schools and in colleges throughout Minnesota with this appropriation. So, again, we appreciate, and in particular, Madam Chair, your work on this as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cirkvenik. I did get a chance to say thank you earlier, but just to be very clear, I want to have the chance to say to the committee thank you for the continued support of the state grant program. It makes a huge difference to low-income students at all types of institutions and probably does the single most work to help improve graduation rates and solve the workforce needs that the state has. So we're very grateful that that's an important part of your bill and your continuing commitment to higher education. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm back. Kevin Parker with MSCSA, Minnesota State College Student Association.
Could you say it louder, please?
Minnesota State College Student Association.
It's Kevin.
Kevin Parker.
Parker, thank you. Kaylee?
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm up here too for support. I'm with the Minnesota State College Student Association. I'm the president, and Kevin Parker is my replacement on July 1st. So
we do this. Congratulations, Mr. Parker! But you didn't say your name for the record.
My apologies.
No, you.
I'm Kaylee. I'm Kaylee Schoonmaker for the record, president of the Minnesota State College Student Association. I'm going to pass it over to Kevin, but I just wanted to thank this committee deeply for prioritizing students. We really appreciate it.
And that. Essentially, Chair and members of the committee, what I was going to say was thank you. We appreciate how you've highlighted our institutions and our students, particularly with supporting our transfer legislation that we requested, the assistance for the technical colleges, the funding for tuition relief particularly. It's been a huge goal of ours every year, really, to make college more affordable and accessible for our students. And we still are the third highest state when it comes to tuition, and it's something that we continue to look forward to working with you all on, but this bill is a good step in that direction. We look forward to working with you further. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Parker. And again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, so Mr. Fuller, please instruct us which actions must now be taken.
We'll do it all at once.
Okay.
So, is Senate File 5 the vehicle?
Yes.
A motion would be to amend Senate File 5 by deleting everything after an enacting clause and the title and insert JCF Article 2-2 as amended, JCF Art 1-1, and fill in the blanks and make technical corrections with the spreadsheet of 414, and then make any technical corrections and mathematical corrections that are necessary. That's the motion. As an aside, then if there is something that turns up that's a big problem, we usually talk to the chair and the leading minority member. I don't foresee that happening. So that's the motion.
Thank you very much. So Senator Claussen moves that motion. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, before we vote, I just want to say thank you to you and your staff in working with the Republicans on this. This is a good bipartisan bill. I'm confident we're going to have bipartisan support today, and you did a great job. And I said this early in committee, and sometimes it gets lost in a lot of this discussions here at the Capitol, but the Higher Education Committee, we are certainly committed to doing what's best for the students, and I think this is a very student-focused proposal here today.
Thank you, Senator Miller. And I do want to remind members that Senator Miller, Senator Claussen, myself, and all of our staff meet once a week and have a staff meeting to prepare the agenda and review and talk about bills. And so it does reflect a bipartisan commitment. So thank you. Senator Claussen.
Great leadership.
Thank you, Senator Claussen. You too. Okay, so Senator Claussen moves as stated by Mr. Fuller. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Committee's adjourned.
So the work of the committee is over, but there will be confirmations.